Here's the thing. Best case scenario now, probably that Donald Trump calls the whole thing off and then asks us all to join him in colluding in the pretense that it never happened. And you can't rule anything out, as we've said on many occasions with this character. He could claim, for example, that he has been completely exonerated by events as he continues to do incomplete ignorance of the truth with regards to the Epstein files. He could claim a glorious victory because, of course, neither he nor any of the warmongering saber-rattlers on this side of the Atlantic have been able to clearly articulate precisely why he undertook this war in the first place. But he ain't going to do it. So up comes Tony Blair.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and...
Play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 10 o'clock, the Prime Minister has promised to protect households from spiralling costs as the Iran conflict pushes up oil prices. Overnight, they exceeded $100 a barrel for the first time since 2022. The FTSE 100 index fell sharply on opening this morning. A short time ago, it was down 1.2%. Speaking during a visit to a community centre in London this morning, Sir Keir Starmer says he's keeping a close eye on the situation.
On the reassurance front, I think it is important just to remind ourselves that last time a conflict began to develop, which was 2022 in relation to Ukraine, the economy wasn't in a stable place, and inflation was 5% and rising. We've done a lot of work in the last 18 months to put some resilience in and make sure that we've got some headroom, which is basically some insurance within the economy.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is expected to join a virtual meeting of G7 finance ministers later to discuss a potential joint release of oil reserves. In other news this morning, LBC can exclusively reveal just one tech company has paid a fine for breaking online safety rules a year after they came in. Ofcom has issued six firms with penalties, totalling more than £3 million, but only 55,000 of that has been paid. The regulator insists it's still a deterrent. Online safety campaigner Ellen Room has told LBC she wants to see even tougher powers.
We've got, you know, the government saying there's going to be this consultation. I really would urge MPs today to back for getting rid of it, to raise the age to 16. We have time and time again proved the harms on these platforms. The MPs just need to stand up and say, enough, take it away. And if the social media companies can prove that their platforms are safe, hey, we can consider giving it back. But it's up to the technology companies now to remove it and get their platforms safe.
You can read more on LBC's Online Safety Day on the LBC app. And it's unclear when Scotland's busiest railway station, Glasgow Central, will reopen following a nearby fire. Services are not stopping there after the fire broke out yesterday in a vape shop. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 132 points at 10,151. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.15. LBC weather, cloudy but dry for most. Some patchy rain in the west, a high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Sorry to interrupt your day, but I've just been diagnosed with dementia, and I'm going to need your help. I'll need help when I can no longer button a shirt or recognise my own family. My daughter will need help too. I worry this could ruin her life. And we will all need help to find a cure to end the devastation of dementia. I can't do this alone.
It will take a society to beat dementia. Alzheimer's Society.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 3 minutes after ten. Who had that on their bingo card? Tony Blair weighs in on the war in Iran, the unfolding war in Iran. I certainly didn't. And that's probably going to be our phone-in this morning. I mean, what for the first hour, at least. What made you... How did you respond to the news? Some of the contortions are extraordinary, aren't they? It's the Daily Mail in particular, as ever. And yes, I am a little bit obsessed. Do you know why I'm a little bit obsessed with the Daily Mail? Are you interested? I'll tell you why. It's a dwindling organ, which has less and less relevance and fewer readers every day. But of course, it still dictates public discourse. But the real reason I'm fascinated by it is because of this job. When I started doing this job, I encountered pretty much for the first time in my life, people whose lives were being ruined by their opinions. whose lives and families were being ruined by their beliefs. This was before Brexit even happened, but you would speak to people whose mums or dads were absolutely convinced that the fact that a family of colour had moved in next door was the end of civilization as they knew it. You would speak to people, and when they rang me, that to explain why they hated immigrants or why they hated the EU. And what I realised was that they had been gaslit over decades into not only believing things that were not true, but into using those things to vote against their own interests, to vote literally for things that would make their own lives worse. You see it a little bit this week with the call from the right-wing media and others to join Donald Trump's ludicrous war in Iran, Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu's ludicrous war in Iran. And they can't really tell you why they're in favour of it, including a lot of the pundits. They give you a reason for why they're in favour of the war, and the very next day Donald Trump will say, no, that's not why we're going to war at all. So you see it happening all the time. And that's why I'm mildly... Oh, I'm not even mild. That's why I'm professionally obsessed with it. I don't give it a great deal of thought when I'm not here or messing around on social media, but that's why. I remember someone telling me a story some time ago about Fox News in the United States of America. And if you ever wondered why we don't have a Fox News equivalent in this country, in terms of popularity, GBB's obviously nibbles at the same territory, nibbles at the same food, but doesn't enjoy anything like the... dominance that Fox News enjoys. The reason why Fox News never really landed in this country is because we already had the Daily Mail. We already had a hideously right-wing organization polluting public discourse, promoting evil people, and persuading populations to vote to keep people like the owners of the Daily Mail in power and in wealth. It really is that simple. And I remember someone telling me years ago that Fox News, when Barack Obama was president, was it a caller to this program or was it somebody I met outside of the studio? I can't actually remember. That their family, their parents had buried their jewelry in the back garden because they'd seen a guest on Fox News claiming that Barack Obama, I think personally, I don't think they were even going to send agents to do it, Barack Obama was going to steal their jewellery in order to fund welfare payments for immigrants, or some absolutely bonkers story like that. And that's why I have an enduring fascination with far-right media and evil commentators and columnists, because they ruin life for everybody, even those of us who can see through their hideous lies. And of course a lot of them can't. I mean, where, for example, is the line? There's some figures today published with regard to immigration. More people have come into the country. The increase in non-EU migration actually overtakes the decrease in EU migration, the latest numbers show. They're both just shy of a million, but the drop in EU migration is more or less entirely filled by the rise in non-EU migration, albeit that the rise in non-EU migration is actually a little bigger than the drop in EU migration, which means, of course, that an awful lot of people from Asian countries, from the subcontinent and from Africa are coming here to fill jobs that were previously done by Europeans, which means, of course, that the preponderance of people who are not white is rising in our workforce as a direct consequence of Brexit. Do you think... This is what I mean by sometimes not knowing whether they're evil or stupid or both. Do you think Nigel Farage knew that this was going to happen and lied about it because his political project will be greatly enhanced by an increase in brown and black faces on supermarket checkouts, or, of course, in adverts, as his colleague has already complained about in very hysterical terms? Do you think he knew that there was going to be a massive uptick in immigration generally and ethnic minority immigration in particular? Or do you think he was too stupid to understand what he was encouraging your mum to vote for? Genuine question. We'll never know the answer. I mean, was he diabolically evil, hoping for a massive uptick in ethnic minority immigration because that powers his political fraud machine? Or he just didn't understand what Brexit would mean in the context of the workforce and was too stupid to grasp what it was that he was going to be directly responsible for? I don't know. We may never know. Speaking of things that we are deriving no pleasure whatsoever from being right about, the introduction I did this time last week about the media's inability to cope with Donald Trump, and this isn't even a criticism because we're all guilty of it, the fact that you cannot not treat the President of the United States of America as one of the most important people on the planet. You cannot not treat his every utterance as if it were global news, because it is. And we don't know how to deal with the fact that what is global news on a Sunday can be the polar opposite of what is global news on a Monday. So I will turn, with your permission, to the Daily Mail first this morning to highlight exactly what I mean. You probably will be aware that Donald Trump was slagging off our Prime Minister again all weekend in sort of unhinged and largely fact-free fashion, but that won't stop the warmongers and the genocide apologists. Don't forget, these two things now go hand in hand on this side of the Atlantic from putting their fingers in their ears and going la 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 while the rest of us point out how insane this entire exercise is. And the right-wing media reports that as if that is the end of civilization as we know it. Donald Trump has slagged off Keir Starmer. The special relationship is over. The wrongest man in the world, Daniel Hannan, said something like, this is the worst thing that's happened to our country since Suez. Which, even by the standards of Daniel Hannan, is pant-wettingly stupid. And that is a man whose pants haven't been dry since 1976. I looked at that story and I thought, I wonder how long it will be before the reverse begins. I wonder how long it will be before relations between Donald Trump and Keir Starmer warm up again. Because that is how it works. And I do not understand why the editor of the Daily Mail, Ted Verity, is too stupid to understand that 24, 48, 36, 72 hours after writing about the end of civilization as we know it and the death of the special relationship and the worst diplomatic crisis since Suez, what was Dick by name Little John saying last week? I've never been more ashamed to be British. I've never been more ashamed to be British. And then you just press fast forward for like a nanosecond and relations will be restored. You just know it's going to happen because it always happens with Donald Trump. What he does on a Monday, he undoes on a Tuesday. What he does on a Tuesday, he undoes on a Wednesday. No, I won't do a Cray David joke at this point because I can't quite remember the lyrics well enough to get it absolutely right. So what does the Daily Mail do now? So guess who didn't speak to Donald Trump this weekend? Nigel Farage. Having boasted about flying to Mar-a-Lago to... he didn't speak to him. Trump wasn't even in the same building. Guess who did speak to Donald Trump this weekend? For good or for ill, Keir Starmer. How the hell does the Daily Mail deal with the fact that the relationship that has completely broken down, the most embarrassing diplomatic incidents in Suez, the end of the special relationship and post-war settlement, the immolation of the Thatcher-Reagan Accords, how on earth do they deal with the fact that it didn't even last until tea time and they're back on the phone to each other within hours? How are we going to report this, they all say to each other in the editorial conference room, because, oh man alive, we look like idiots again. They never say to each other in the editorial conference room. So they go with Starmer's humbling phone call to Trump. Humbling for who? Humbling for the guy who was trying to give the impression that the relationship was over, or humbling for the guy who has managed to pursue an entirely straight course since this debacle began? The idea that Churchill and FDR never had arguments or disagreements with each other is typical of the kind of historical ignorance you would need to write the sort of bilge that the Mail is now writing about Iran, and that Daniel Hannan has been writing since he was in short trousers. And of course, all the rest of them as well, Dick by name, Little John, and all of the sort of weird, saber-rattling cowards who are absolutely terrified of refugees, but currently in the middle of calling for Keir Starmer to contribute to causing what could be one of the biggest refugee crises we've ever seen. So where are we? Where are we? 10:13 is the time. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. I'll tell you where we are. Tony Blummin' Blair. Tony Blummin' Blair popped up this weekend. He has subsequently claimed that he was at a private event and wasn't expecting his comments to be made public, which is, I suppose, an illustration of what happens when Peter Mandelson is no longer around to advise you on communication matters. But Tony Blummin' Blair this weekend, let it be known that he felt Donald Trump should have joined, that Keir Starmer should have joined Donald Trump's probably illegal war in Iran. Tony Blair. How old do you have to be to have a genuine sense of shock at the sheer bloody front of the man? How old do you have to be to feel in your bones a repulsion at the entitlement, the arrogance, and the absence of self-awareness on the part of Tony Blair here? I mean, is there an age? I guess if you've studied the Iraq War, then you could probably get a free pass if you're a little bit too young to actively remember it. But the Iraq War was an unparalleled disaster. Arguably, it was always destined to be so. We'll have another look at some of the Chilcot report later in the programme and remind ourselves of all the lessons that are now being completely ignored by the likes of Kemi Badenoch, Nigel Farage and all of the right-wing columnists. And broadcasters, of course, we shouldn't let them off the hook. Wrong about everything. Brexit, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss, austerity, Donald Trump, but not pausing for a moment to wade in. Wrong about Iraq as well, although I'm on that list. Wading in to call for more war. Down with Starmer, up with Trump. More war. Calling for all of these things. And Tony Blair joined their ranks this weekend. Whether he intended these comments to be more widely known or not seems to me to be moot. Tony Blair calling for Keir Starmer to join a war that Keir Starmer was opposed to. He was opposed to Iraq in 2003. The line he's adopted with regard to Iran is entirely consistent with what he wrote about Iraq in 2003. So you just have to ignore that. If you're a professional commentator or a right-wing politician or a Donald Trump fluffer, you just have to ignore that fact. What do you mean Keir Starmer's been entirely consistent for the best part of a quarter of a century on exactly the circumstances in which a war like this would be lawful? Oh, we don't want to worry about things like laws. It's absolutely extraordinary that Chilcot's all there. The bit of the good operation, the evaluation section of the good operation, which is a kind of précis of much of Chilcot's findings, make it absolutely clear what should and should not happen in times like this and in circumstances like this. And guess who thinks that we should ignore it? Guess who thinks that we should completely ignore the findings of the £10 million, 7 year long, millions upon millions of words, 12 volumes. Guess who thinks we should completely ignore the findings, the lessons of the Iraq War, and the conclusions of the Chilcot inquiry? Go on, have a guess. Tony Blimmin Blair. Popping up the, what do we call him? The Burk of Baghdad? I don't know. But popping up to lecture Keir Starmer, an international lawyer of some repute, on why he should join a definitely unwise and most probably illegal war in the Middle East. Sorry, I've got that wrong. Another definitely unwise and most probably illegal war in the Middle East. I just found it breathtaking. I don't know what sort of mood you're in this morning. I suspect, like me, you are split between fascination with the unfolding of events, knowledge that we all have a responsibility to understand as much as we can, and fear of the fact that some of the worst humans in history are now in charge of another probably illegal war in the Middle East. And I don't put Tony Blair on that list. You can attack me for that if you want. I think his legacy without Iraq would be almost entirely positive. If you speak to people from Kosovo or Sierra Leone, you will not recognise the man that they describe. It was not a joke last week when I told you that there are children currently running around Kosovo whose first name is Tony Blair. All one word. Tony Blair. They're called Tony Blair. That's their name. Tony Blair. Because he is considered to be a hero. Similarly in Sierra Leone. And it was that desire for a hat trick, that slightly avaricious desire, atavistic desire for a hat trick that probably prompted him to close his eyes and follow George W. Bush blindly into Baghdad. But he has weighed in on this. He has weighed in on this to the point where, and I mean, this is actually hilarious, to the point where the Daily Mail has to undertake the sort of contortions that you'd think even they would be capable of clocking. So if you were to go back to the moment that Chilcot was published, which, I mean, you're looking at July 2016. We were probably a little bit distracted at the time. The Daily Mail goes with a headline This is what I mean, and this is why everyone should be as interested in this as I am, because these people have poisoned the well of public discourse for generations. They took us out of the European Union. They put Liz Truss in Downing Street. They told us Boris Johnson, who they still pay hundreds of thousands of pounds a year for his bloviations, would be brilliant. They explained away austerity as the reason why we should punish Sure Start centres in South Shields for the failures of bankers in 2008. But what you must not do is blame the bankers. They did all of this stuff. I told you Donald Trump was going to be great for the United Kingdom. And they told you in 2016 that Tony Blair was, and I quote, a monster of delusion. A monster of delusion. For 2 hours, Blair dissembled and denied in the face of Chilcot's devastating verdict. Then, with sickening egomania, he declared, I can't say sorry for Iraq, I'd do it again. And fast forward 10 years, give or take, to March of 2026, and they have the barefaced audacity, these quislings, these traitors to the national interest, these absolute saboteurs of our national tapestry. They have the barefaced audacity, the utter absence of self-awareness, to cite Tony Blair's support for the war in Iran as bad news for Keir Starmer. What a difference a decade makes. 10 years ago, for the mavens at the Daily Mail, Tony Blair was a monster of delusion who was refusing to learn the lessons of Chilcot. First lesson of Chilcot, don't go into Iran. 10 years later, now Blair delivers a stinging blow to PM over war. So Tony Blair has gone from being a monster of delusion to being a paragon of principle whose support for the war in Iran is a great humiliation and embarrassment for Keir Starmer, who, by the way, spent the weekend on the phone to the bloke who they told you last week was never going to talk to him again. All of which makes it crystal clear that anybody still in support of this war is either an idiot or an idiot. And Tony Blair, unfortunately, is probably the only exception to that rule, because his reasons for supporting this war are going to be a little bit different from yours and mine, if indeed we were stupid enough to support it. And that's what I want to analyse today. So, question number one, straight up, draw on whatever interest, history, experiences you please. What was your reaction to Tony Blair criticising Keir Starmer for not supporting Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump's almost certainly illegal war? By the way, there's a new Ayatollah in town. I don't know if you knew this. He's the same as the old one. I mean, literally, he's the son of the old one. And according to most experts, he's worse. He's more, quotes, hardline, end quotes, than the last bloke, who was supposed to be the most hardline person on the planet. So it's all going brilliantly well. They've replaced the old Ayatollah with his own son, who is more hardline than the old fella. The regime is still in place. There's no sign of the rebellion on the streets, which is a pretty obvious consequence of almost all the guns belonging to the 20% of the population that are still supportive of the regime. And Donald Trump is claiming that he's already won. Except when he's claiming that he hasn't already won, and therefore he needs to do X, Y, and Z to ensure that he does win. I said it 20 minutes ago, and I'll say it again. Best thing that can happen now? Donald Trump just calls the whole thing off and pretends it never happened. Marches around claiming victory, or literally pretending that it never happened. I've been completely exonerated. I don't know what else counts as a good case scenario. But I do know this. You have thoughts on Tony Blair's intervention, and I want to know what they are. Because I have a theory that if you were wavering on this, and you can be forgiven for wavering, given the amount of effort and energy that's put into promoting the course that would be worse for Britain, if you were wavering on this, I have a theory that Tony Blair coming in and saying we should do it would actually be the thing that pushed you into the camp saying, no, we blimmin' shouldn't. I genuinely can't imagine anybody observing the events of last week, ending up come Friday night, Saturday night, in a place of some confusion and uncertainty, waking up on Sunday morning to discover that Tony Blair has said Keir Starmer should have joined this illegal war, and going, oh, well, that changes everything. Come on, Starmer, pull your socks up and get us into Iran as soon as possible. I genuinely don't believe, up to and including his own family, that anybody would respond to Tony Blair's call for another illegal war in the Middle East by deciding that just the thing we need and the thing we should be doing is to join another illegal war in the Middle East. And we haven't even mentioned the Board of Peace, have we? It's very late. I'm getting told off. I should probably turn this into a phone-in, but I don't have to. I'm more than happy to carry on. If you'd like to interrupt me, the number you need is 0345-6060-973. You now have a, dare I say, a slightly better understanding of everything that's going on than perhaps you had at 10 o'clock, but I want to know what your reaction is to Tony Blair sticking his oar in. 0345-6060-973. Your reaction. Has he made it better or worse? Has he changed your mind? Has he confirmed your ideas? Or has he introduced something to the mix that I've missed? Tony Blair calling on Keir Starmer to attack Iran. Your thoughts after this.
LBC.
This is what award-winning customer service sounds like from real Octopus Energy calls.
I've dealt with many utility companies for many years across several properties, and Octopus are an absolute breath of fresh air.
Octopus Energy, great value and outstanding customer service, recommended by Which 9 years running.
When you're smiling,
don't let missing teeth stop you smiling. At Banning Dental, our experts could restore your beautiful smile with premium dental implants. See online for our price match promise. Banning Dental Group Clinics. Keep on smiling.
Keep on smiling and the whole world smiles with you.
BanningDental.co.uk.
My name is Karen, and this is my NHS story. You don't realise how blind you are until you have cataract surgery. I was referred to a surgical hub, and they booked us in for an operation. It was about 3 weeks before I was there. It's very, very quick.
The government is opening more surgical hubs, with more than 120 already operating across England, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS fit for the future.
Octopus Energy, great value and outstanding customer service, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running.
This is LBC. Message James O'Brien on WhatsApp now on 0345 6060973.
It's 26 minutes after 10. You are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. And it's an odd question. It's not one that I was expecting to ask on a Monday morning. But Tony Blair has weighed in on Keir Starmer's decision to pursue international law, to obey international law and to heed the lessons of the Chilcot inquiry, the 7-year, £10 million inquiry into all the mistakes that Tony Blair made when he took us to war in Iraq. And Blair's intervention is to attack Starmer for not repeating his own mistakes. That's my analysis of the situation. You're welcome to challenge it, but I warn you now, you're going to have your ducks in a row if you think you can, because it seems to fit the circumstances in front of us almost perfectly, up to and including the weapons-grade hypocrisy and reverse ferret of the Daily Mail, who've gone from calling Tony Blair the Antichrist in terms to claiming that because he's in favour of this war, another war in the Middle East, then Keir Starmer must pay attention and somehow be humiliated by the intervention. Alan's in Prestwich. Alan, what would you like to say?
Morning, James.
Hello, Alan.
I'm speaking as a Labour councillor, James, and this is now coming up on the doorstep.
Oh, yeah, go on.
And, well, you know, this, people are saying Starmer's right. What they're saying is Starmer's done the right thing, and this is people who might not be voting Labour or were thinking of voting Labour supporters but a bit cheesed off.
Yeah.
But they are saying now Starmer's doing the right thing. Now, when I first heard what Blair said, my initial reaction was, you're wrong. You are absolutely wrong. And for me, this is make or break for Keir Starmer. He has got to basically stand up, keep standing up to Trump and saying, them bases can be used to defend our allies and British citizens, but you are not using them to attack Iran. And if that means the end of the special relationship, see you, pal.
I don't even know what that means anymore, the end of the special... I should find this Daniel Hannan piece, because even by Daniel Hannan's standards, it was absolutely hilarious, mate. It's the worst domestic... it's the worst diplomatic crisis since Suez, Alan. I don't know if news has reached Prestwich yet, but, I mean, you know, this is a national humiliation the likes of which we haven't seen in 50 years.
Well, it's just the same as Harold Wilson with Vietnam when he made the right decision.
Well, forgive me for asking this question, but you're a little older than me. Do you have a full memory of that period?
I remember the Vietnam War because I'm 66 in June.
A bit, probably still a bit young there. What was the sort of the media wasn't quite the cesspit that it is now. The Daily Mirror was still a very strong force, and you know, decency and transparency were still values that some newspapers upheld. But do we know what happened to Wilson when he opposed Vietnam? Did the sort of contemporary equivalent of Dick by Name Little John and all the rest of them, did they all start shilling for America? Were they all accusing Harold Wilson of being a disgrace? Were they ashamed to be British because we didn't go to war in Vietnam alongside the Americans? Do you remember?
In all honesty, James, I can't remember.
Well, you're no use.
Some of the press might have been run by what we call old school One Nation Tories, who might have had a brain.
Yeah. I mean, looking back, it was obviously 100% the correct thing to do. And looking back, I think Starmer's course will prove to be 100% the correct thing to do. But I was just interested in the historical parallel with Vietnam. Why then do you think Tony Blair has done it? And you can indulge, if you want, in a little bit of amateur psychology, or possibly professional psychology, Alan. I haven't got your CV in front of me. Why do you think Tony Blair has done it?
I've absolutely no idea. I think what the words I saw was, you know, if you're allies with America, then you've got to do whatever they say.
Yeah.
But, you know, but the thing is, I'll quote Donald Trump. Donald Trump is not even a George W. Bush.
He makes George W. Bush look like... Who wrote The Art of War? He makes him look like Napoleon. Anyway, carry on.
No, but, you know, the thing is, you're talking to someone who is unhinged, and I saw that video of that sort of... It almost seemed like a seance in the White House with the right-wing Christian fundamentalists and all this.
Holding their arms over his head. I mean, I probably didn't explain that very clearly on the radio. I played the tape, but I didn't explain the physicality of it. It was bonkers.
Yeah, but, you know, the thing is, the Republican Party, the GOP, has been, like, just taken over by the MAGA movement. And again, James... The cost to Britain of not being in Europe, because if Trump threatens us...
Get back on the flipping subject, under discussion, says the pot to the kettle. Why has he done it? What's he playing at?
I honestly don't know, but I tell you what, James, he's wrong, 100%. And as I said to you about 2 minutes ago, Keir Starmer has got to stick to this one like glue. That's his position, he's non-negotiable.
I think he finds this stuff quite easy, actually, and I don't mean that in a. I like the word glib. I think you just used it, but I don't mean that in a glib sense, or I don't think he is glib. I think he finds it quite easy because that's what he has spent his entire life studying and affecting. I'll run you through the Chilcot checklist after the news, and you can have a little reflection on what Keir Starmer is doing and how closely he follows the lessons of the inquiry into the Iraq War. Can you believe I'm saying that? In 2026. The lessons of the inquiry into the Iraq War and the question of whether or not Keir Starmer has learned them, because we know that Tony Blair has not. I can't actually believe this. I know I sometimes indulge in a little bit of hyperbole, but Chilcot was 7 years in the making. It was 10 million quid. Even the Daily Mail was all over it at the time because they used it, I realise now, simply as a stick with which to beat Tony Blair. They didn't care about the dead soldiers or the dead, God forbid, the dead Iraqis. They didn't care about the false intelligence or the dodgy intelligence, the weapons of mass destruction, the dodgy dossier. They used Chilcot only as a stick with which to beat Tony Blair. And how do I know that? Because when the same bloke comes out and says something they like in the same circumstances, they're all over him. They're all over him like a rash. That is what happens if you have no principles, no morals, no scruples, and no integrity. Dominic Ellis has your headlines.
Sir Keir Starmer has admitted that the conflict in Iran will likely impact the UK, but the government is working to protect households and businesses. Overnight, oil prices exceeded $100 a barrel for the first time since 2022. The FTSE 100 index fell sharply on opening this morning. A short time ago, it was down 1.2%. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will join an emergency virtual meeting of G7 finance ministers later to discuss the situation. In other news, LBC can exclusively reveal only one tech company has paid a fine for breaking the Online Safety Act a year after coming into force. Ofcom has issued six firms penalties totalling more than £3 million for things like not putting proper age checks on their sites. And it's unclear when Scotland's busiest railway station will reopen following a nearby fire. Services are not stopping at Glasgow Central after a fire broke out yesterday in a vape shop. LBC weather, cloudy but dry. For most, some patchy rain in the west, a high of 15 degrees.
This is LBC.
You've probably been with the same energy supplier for decades. And why wouldn't you be? Loyalty matters. But lately, bigger hasn't always felt better. You've probably dealt with long waits and endless automated menus in search of someone who can actually help. Octopus Energy is now Britain's biggest energy supplier, trusted by over 8 million customers, because we do things differently. Our people focus on the most important thing, you. When you call, you'll speak to a real person. No robotic scripts, no computer says no, just an honest conversation with someone who actually wants to help. Join the millions who've already made the move. Octopus Energy, recommended by Which, a record 9 years running. Visit octopus.energy/better for verification.
I'm Leah, and this is my NHS story. I could just feel my body didn't feel right, and my GP referred me to CDC. Had some blood tests done, and within 24 hours I had my results. And that just reassured me that I was being taken seriously.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
Hi, I'm Sava, founder of Cool You. And when it comes to getting aircon into London's hot and stuffy apartments and listed buildings, I'm the daddy. For years, Cool You have supplied and installed fully internal aircon systems with no mess, no fuss, and no external condensers. So head to coolyou.london today. Cool You, for a cool, comfortable home.
Pets in a pickle. We're here when it matters most. For fuss-free pet insurance policies as unique as they are, visit petsinapickle.co.uk.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
It's 10:36. Some of your texts. The circumstances surrounding Iraq and Iran are so similar. There's no conceivable way Blair could be against this without having to admit that 2003 was a terrible mistake. That's from Paul. Hayden writes, if Blair says we should be shoulder to shoulder with Trump, then it confirms even more firmly that Starmer's approach is correct. That's Hayden in Croydon. Stephen in Glasgow, my reaction to Blair's intervention was, of course he flipping did. He's as twisted and evil as Trump. I'm ashamed I once voted for him. I wouldn't personally go that far, but I find this latest intervention deeply troubling. Nikki writes, the new Ayatollah will be very aware that America killed his mum and dad. What could possibly go wrong? And Mark concludes, Tony Blair was a hero of mine. I think Mark speaks for many, bringing hope in 1997 when he was elected. I even gave him the benefit of the doubt with the Iraq war because I always thought he was given bad intelligence from Bush. I think that position is still defensible. Now, however, Mark writes, he is dead to me. I think he was a brilliant prime minister and I think he was a great statesman and I think that Iraq was a terrible, terrible mistake that does correctly undo, in terms of legacy and memory, an awful lot of the good that he did. But the Chilcot inquiry, of course, was there to repair some of the damage, to provide lessons that, if we learned them, would equip us not to march into the same mistake again, let alone the same territory, let alone the neighbouring country. Here is Tony Blair speaking in the immediate aftermath of Chilcot's findings.
The intelligence assessments made at the time of going to war turned out to be wrong. The aftermath turned out to be more hostile, protracted and bloody than ever we imagined. The coalition planned for one set of ground facts and encountered another. And a nation whose people we wanted to set free and secure from the evil of Saddam became instead victim to sectarian terrorism. For all of this, I express more sorrow, regret, and apology than you may ever know or can believe.
I'm going to ask you, Cathy, bear with me one moment. I'm going to ask you to listen to that again. And then I'm going to ask you to answer the question of why Tony Blair is telling Keir Starmer to join Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu's war in Iran. So listening to the points that he makes and the contrition, whether it's authentic or not, is, of course, in the ear of the beholder. But I want you to listen to this. Then I'll run you through the Chilcot checklist. And then I want you to tell me why Tony Blair, and it's news, in the same way that if the President of the United States says something, even if we know he'll say the opposite 10 minutes later, you have to report it as if it is a moment of great import. Tony Blair's not in that category. He doesn't say the opposite 10 minutes later of what he said yesterday. But he is a significant enough figure, one of this country's longest-serving prime ministers, to merit this level of attention. Of course he is. Even if he hadn't led us into the war in Iraq, his comments would be important. His views would be essential, listening. But I don't get it. Why is he listening to this? Why is he calling for Keir Starmer to essentially do all the things that he appears to be apologising for doing here?
The intelligence assessments made at the time of going to war turned out to be wrong. The aftermath turned out to be more hostile, protracted and bloody than ever we imagined. The coalition planned for one set of ground facts and encountered another. And a nation whose people we wanted to set free and secure from the evil of Saddam became instead victim to sectarian terrorism. For all of this, I express more sorrow, regret, and apology than you may ever know or can believe.
So let's run through it again. The intelligence that they went to war on was the bogus intelligence regarding weapons of mass destruction. Benjamin Netanyahu has, as you know, been claiming that Iran was poised to create a nuclear capability since 1996, claiming they were just days away from it. There is no evidence that they have a capability that worthy of an invasion like this one. In fact, even if they did, they told us 9 months ago that they'd completely destroyed it. So they were lying then, or they were lying now, or they're lying on both occasions. There's absolutely no possibility that they were telling the truth twice. The aftermath. Well, it's too early to say what the long-term aftermath will be, but the short-term aftermath has seen the old Ayatollah replaced by the new Ayatollah, who just happens to be his son, and who is reportedly even more hardline than his old man. Again, I will tell you, nobody mourns, or I certainly don't mourn, all but a relatively small support proportion of the Iranian population will mourn the passing of either Ayatollah. But it's the circumstances in which you do these things that matters, and that's why Chilcot was called in the first place. The desire was to set the people free. I've heard that claim used in the context of Iran as well, from the usual know-nothing blowhards. Oh, the human rights abuses are terrible. Okay, so how are you going to improve the lot of the people whose human rights are being abused? We're going to bomb them. That's the way. That's the way forward. So all of those things that he mentioned seem to me to be at least in play or are already in parallel. And that brings us to the Chilcot checklist, which we'll have a look at shortly. But first, Cathy is in Axminster. Cathy, what was your reaction to Tony Blair's decision to stick his oar in?
Hello, James.
Hello, Cathy.
It's partly just too depressing to articulate, but second...
Well, you're going to have to try, mate. It's a phone-in show.
Not a surprise, because this man's Achilles heel is his vanity. It's his vanity with George Bush's arm around him got him into Iraq. And I wrote to him at the time, because I was much more politically active. I'm over 80 now. Yeah. I wrote to him and told him, when he put one of these letters in the press saying, oh, poor me, you know, it's all terrible and everything, I wrote to him and said, go and crawl around Iraq and around the stuff that's in the ground, you know, all those bomb cluster bombs and stuff. I didn't hold back at all. I wrote to Claire Short as well. It was a dreadful time, and I marched against it. I haven't got the energy to march now. But anyway, he's popped up again, and I thought, there you go, there's vanity for you. He is a vain man. He can't step down. He's quite capable of doing other good stuff, but he can't step down. I mean, when we first heard of him, was it Cambridge he went to? He was in a band. Awesome. He likes to enter stage. This is his psychology.
Well, I mean, you can't, I'm afraid, you can't sign me up to launch attacks on show-offs. Even by my standards, that would be a hypocrisy too far. But it doesn't fully explain this, does it? I mean, lots of us have a capacity to show off or a fondness for the spotlight. But the juxtaposition, and I appreciate you'd rung in before I played that clip, but all of the things that he's apologising for there appear to be happening again.
Yes, it's a parallel. And I'm at a loss to know how he doesn't get it. He has no idea how disliked he is by the UK, except by, you know, the Daily Mail and co.
Well, they hate him, but yesterday they loved him.
Yes. Well, it depends whether
because he's a stick, they can, like, pick him up by the ankles and hit Keir Starmer over the head with him. It's pretty straightforward, and, of course, nobody ever stops to wonder how on earth we're getting away with publishing such epic hypocrisy. But psychologically, is it not even simpler, perhaps? Is it not the case that if he criticised Keir Starmer, he would be implicitly admitting that he made a terrible mistake back in the day? Because if the more similar the situations are, then the more hard it will be for Tony Blair to passionately oppose intervention in Iran, because it would highlight the epic and fatal, the lethal scale of his error.
Yes.
With regard to Iraq.
Exactly. When I wrote to him, I said, you know, you're doing something that's going to set the Middle East on fire. And lo and behold, yes, and I'm sure I wasn't the only one writing to him.
No, you clearly weren't. But what gave you your insights, just out of interest?
My insights?
Yeah, why did you arrive at that conclusion when so many, not as you rightly say, lots and lots of people were similarly concerned and have been proved right by events, but an awful lot of people who, I don't think we're all idiots in the way that everyone supporting this war is certainly in the running to be considered an idiot. Why could you see so clearly what they failed to see at all, do you think?
Well, it was at the time of the Iraq war, and I could see, and that clip you played earlier on showed me in Tony Blair's voice, the vanity in his voice, which I knew then, but it's even more strong now. But I think he's not completely like Trump, but they've got a similar gene of vanity. That they can't sit down and be quiet, and they have to be right, and they have to be centre stage. I wish politicians, before they went to be leaders, would spend a bit of time on a psychiatrist's couch, frankly.
Well, I think this is psychological, actually, today. I mean, it could be material, couldn't it? There could be self-interest involved. He's on the board of peas. I don't really understand why. He sits there with people like the Prime Minister of Hungary, who's a massive cheerleader for Vladimir Putin and sundry other people who are not really, you'd be stretching the definition of world leaders. But he's on there, and he has signed up for it, and I don't understand why he has let it be known that he feels Keir Starmer should, under, I think, a pretty irresistible analysis, repeat the mistakes that Tony Blair made himself when he went into Iraq. 0345 6060973 is the number that you need. It's 10:46.
Tom Swarbrick on LBC.
We have a problem with Islamist sympathisers who are very happy, indeed proud, to use the liberties hard won, hard fought for in this country to express yourself freely and openly, to give over a worldview that is completely at odds with those very freedoms. Completely at odds with them. We have a problem.
Tom Swarbrick, Monday to Friday from 4 p.m. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
I'm Natasha, and this is my NHS story. I went to the GP because I'd found a lump in my breast, and the GP referred me to a CDC centre. It was just really welcoming from the moment I arrived. To just be reassured all in one day was fantastic.
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
What's the best present you ever got for your birthday? I bet it wasn't as life-changing as £1 million. Every week with the birthday draw, there's £1 million to be won. And you can enter from as little as £1, or via post. Enter by midnight on Sunday, and your special day could win you £1 million. Visit thebirthdaydraw.com. Is it your lucky day? From Global and ITV. 18 plus, UK only, no purchase necessary.
Amazon offers term time working to their employees, like Anton, who's home to look after his daughters during their holidays.
Hello!
To him, this is the best sound in the world. Actually, maybe that's the best sound of all. Now that's term time working. Offered at Amazon. 10 weeks off guaranteed per year. Mix of paid holiday and unpaid time off. Conditions apply.
A message from TfL.
I saw him in the local news a few days after. His name's Rakesh. They had to put him into a coma just because I didn't look again at that turning. He had two kids. How did I not see his bike ahead of me? Well, I didn't look again. He didn't make it.
Drivers, take another look, not a life. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters.
It's time to scale up that fishmonger business, Anne. With free day-to-day online banking from Virgin Money, you'll be a big fish in no time. Now that's a real catch of the day. Open Virgin Money's M account for business now. UK excludes NI, Channel Islands and Isle of Man. 18 plus fees apply for chaps and international payments. Terms and exclusions apply. Backed by the current account switch service. Virgin Money is a trading name. Applies to Bank PLC.
James O'Brien. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
10:49 is the time. I mean, it could be. The thing about psychology is it's usually a bit more straightforward than politics. Certainly a bit more straightforward than real politics. Tony Blair, if you asked him, and the circumstances in which he made these comments are a little bit disputed. What's not disputed is that he was not intending them to reach a wider audience. He was attending an event that was supposedly observing the Chatham House rule, which means, you know, what goes on tour stays on tour. But even so, to examine the psychology that drives him to call upon Keir Starmer to repeat the mistakes that he himself made with regard to the invasion of Iraq is fascinating. And maybe it simply is the case that doing so would involve an epic culpability on his part. He simply can't contemplate it. And also, if we take Kathy's analysis of vanity and what have you, then you wouldn't want him to look bad, as it were, by in comparison. Keir Starmer wrote in 2003 in the Guardian newspaper that Tony Blair should not go to war in Iraq and laid out the reasons. And speaking of reasons, here's the Chilcot checklist, all right? The 10 things that would, having spent 7 years and £10 million on seeking to learn the lessons of Iraq, here are the 10 things that we should do now that we didn't do then. Question number one, vision. Why do we care? What does this mean for British interests? What are the risks of acting or doing nothing, including in the longer term? What is different now? So there's your question. What is different now compared to a year ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago? Answer, well, nothing. And of course, we can thank Benjamin Netanyahu for that, because he's been gibbering on about how Iran is just days away from having terrible, terrible weapons capabilities since at least 1996. And of course, they told us 9 months ago that they destroyed them all. So the worst case scenario is that you can't trust them. The best case scenario is that you can't trust them and nothing is different now. Analysis. Point two, what is happening now? Where are you getting your evidence from? Have assumptions been exposed to analytical tools or external challenge? Hands up if you think Donald Trump has taken really expert analysis and advice over the wisdom and feasibility of this exercise. Go on, hands up now. Put your hand in the air if you think Donald Trump has consulted the finest legal and military minds in the world. Because if you're putting your hand up now, I've got a bridge I'd like to sell you. So that's point two. And this isn't some made-up checklist on flipping BuzzFeed. This is the consequences, the results, the distillation of the Chilcot inquiry. What is happening now? Have assumptions been exposed to analytical tools or external challenge? Donald Trump wouldn't know an analytical tool if it sat on his head. Number three, scenarios. What might happen next? Have you looked at a range of options and scenarios and consequences that could flow from these? Donald Trump told us that they accidentally killed most of the people that they had in mind to replace the last Ayatollah, and didn't tell us that he would actually be replaced by the new Ayatollah, who is the old Ayatollah's son. So, have they done point one? No. Have they done point two? No. Have they done point three? No. Point four, what should we do? This is your options. Have you designed your options collaboratively? Built-in challenge? And presented ministers with clear information on risks, opportunities and costs. Keir Starmer has done that, of course. That's why his position changes after Iran attacks British allies and, to a certain degree, British bases. This is the point that I really want you to understand, because I met some perfectly decent people this weekend who didn't. When they launched the illegal attacks, Starmer observed international law and stayed out. When Iran responded, Starmer observed international law and got involved. They are two completely different propositions determined by two completely different sets of circumstances. And then we come to number five. How do we ensure that action is lawful? Again, Starmer's got it right. Trump has got it wrong. What is the wider legal context? Are ministers aware of any legal risks? What are the policy implications? How will you ensure that any legal basis remains sound if circumstances change? That's just five of them. I should get Tom on in Barcelona before I do the other five. Otherwise, you might be forgiven thinking that this is just one big extended monologue. Tom, what would you like to say?
Is it not that Tony Blair's just seen an opportunity? He's seen a turn in the tide and he sees a chance to be exonerated. You know, if we look back at his premiership, I'm a little bit too young to remember his premiership, but
okay.
I do know that he, you know, on paper has one of the most impressive, you know, prime ministerialships in history, right?
Yeah.
And whenever I bring that up to Tories, they all sort of, they automatically just turn with, well, Iraq.
Which they all supported, of course. But you don't need me to remember. Well, maybe you do, actually, given your age. There was more support for the war in Iraq in the Tory benches than there was on the Labour benches.
So maybe he sees this as a way to say, right, if I can win public favour in that, and also based on the fact that I've, you know, by any metric, unemployment and you name
it. The public are massively against this war.
If he can turn around the Tories' mind around what they've done, what they say around, you know, being able to, for example, challenge him on whether or not he went to war in the first place, whether he had the right information, whether or not he had the right data, for him to be able to say, well, now they agree with me. Look at my entire premiership.
I mean, this doesn't happen very often, but you've completely lost me.
Well, If, for example, he's won every, you know, Tory over on the fact that they all think that he went to war for all of the wrong reasons, but now they turn their mind. Look at Kemi Badenoch coming out and saying that, you know, oh, he's right to go, he should have gone into war. Now he's turning that round and turning around, he sees just an opportunity to exonerate himself, basically.
Well, I could see it So you're not arguing that he genuinely believes that regime change in Iran is both desirable and possible?
I'm just saying it could be totally self-serving.
Himself
off the hook.
But he's not getting off any hooks. That's the point that you've got me completely baffled by. Public opinion in the United States and in the UK is squarely against this. And the idea that he's doing it to suck up to the Daily Mail fits your analysis, but it's a bit of a stretch, mate.
bit of a stretch, maybe.
He spent the best part of 25 years... nearly 30 years, absolutely livid that the Daily Mail abandoned him in his hour of need, and he wants to restore relations, he wants to be rehabilitated by Dick by name Little John and Ted Verity, and, you know, truth, legacy and the people of Iran be damned, I'm going to do what you want me to do because I'm desperate for your approval in 2020. Come off it, mate. Nah.
One
option. Viva España, Tom, but unless I've misunderstood you, I don't want you to hang up thinking I've been rude.
No, not at all. I was just thinking it and...
Hey, that's what I encourage. I'm all for it, because that's the point about vacuums. When a vacuum exists, why has Tony Blair done what he's done? Then anything can move into it, but I think you're going to have to get up a bit earlier to get that one inflated. If anybody else wants to have a crack at pursuing Tom's point, you know what to do. But the central question of why on earth Tony Blair has done it is, I think, probably going to be answered with Occam's razor, which is because if he wasn't in favour of this, he would be carrying He would be implicit. I mean, the guilt he must carry over Iraq is a guilt he can never articulate. I played that little clip of him, but he's also come pretty close in the past to saying he would do the same things again. It wasn't the decision to go to war that was flawed. It was the execution and the detail. And of course, if he were to articulate, if he were on a therapist's couch or a psychiatrist's couch, that stuff is huge. And that's like internal trauma on a scale that most of us will happily never, ever experience. You did it. You caused it. You greenlit it. And then Starmer facing a very, very similar dilemma. He has to encourage Starmer to do the same thing that he did. Otherwise, he would have to really sit with the misery, the pain and the horror of exactly what it is that he did. I've got the other five. There is one theory that we haven't heard yet. And I've just seen somebody suggest that their wife pointed it out this morning. I wonder if you can work out what it is. But the positive analysis of what Tony Blair has done, which would fly in the face of Tom in Barcelona's analysis, of course, which is that it's to exonerate himself and to curry favour with the cheerleaders for the four donkeys of the Krapopolips, the Johnson fans, the austerity fans, the Brexit fans, the Truss fans, the Trump fans. What do you reckon it is? I quite like this as a theory. It's the sort of thing Peter Mandelson might have dreamt up. I wonder whatever happened to him. But I don't think it's going to float. What I do think might float is a further question about why we think Tony Blair is doing what he's doing, with a side order of, should the King go to the United States next month? A full state visit next month. It's mere weeks away. And if he shouldn't go, how should he get out of it?
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 11 o'clock, Sir Starmer has admitted the Iran conflict will likely impact the UK, but says work is underway to protect households and businesses. Overnight, oil prices exceeded $100 a barrel. The FTSE 100 index also fell sharply on opening earlier. A short time ago, it was down 1.2%. The Prime Minister says the government is monitoring the economic situation closely.
The Chancellor is talking to the Bank of England every day. I would just say on energy prices for households, the energy price cap is in place until June, and therefore we're not anticipating that is going to change, which will give a degree of reassurance.
The Chancellor, Rachel Rees, will join an emergency virtual meeting of G7 finance ministers later. Christian May is the editor of City AM. He's keeping a close eye on market developments for LBC.
There will be volatility, there will be some winners, there'll be some movement, but overall it's a pretty ropey picture for the markets. It's quite a scary picture for oil. And a little surprise, therefore, that ministers, we understand, are going to be talking today about accessing strategic reserves across different countries in the world, and in this country, talking about how the government could intervene to prevent this from seriously spilling over into the consumer economy.
Ofcom says fines for technology firms failing to keep children safe online are acting as a deterrent. LBC can exclusively reveal only one company has paid a penalty for breaking the Online Safety Act a year after coming into force. The regulator has issued six firms with fines totalling more than £3 million, but only 55,000 of that has been paid. Tory peer Baroness Morgan has told LBC News that she wants to see even tougher powers.
When the next version of the Online Safety Act comes around, the measures that Ofcom can use, how quickly they can react, are all things that are going to have to be looked at again.
There's more on this story on the LBC app. And fire crews remain at the scene of yesterday's major fire close to Glasgow Central Station. A fire broke out at a vape shop, with rail services still disrupted this morning. Part of the 19th century building partially collapsed. No injuries have been reported. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 152 at 10,131. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.15. LBC weather, cloudy but dry for most today. Some patchy rain for the west, a high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Sorry to interrupt your day, but I've just been diagnosed with dementia and I'm going to need your help. I'll need help when I can no longer button a shirt or recognise my own family. My daughter will need help too. I worry this could ruin her life. And we will all need help to find a cure to end the devastation of dementia. I can't do this alone.
It will take a society to beat dementia. Alzheimer's Society.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
Three minutes after 11 is the time. This from 10 years ago, give or take a couple of months. Tony Blair has rejected the Chilcot Inquiry's criticism of his decision to lead Britain to war in Iraq in 2003, but expressed sorrow, regret and apology for some mistakes he made in planning the conflict. I think that the image is coming into focus, isn't it, here? The idea that Tony Blair, by rejecting Chilcot, essentially puts himself in a position where he has little choice but to encourage Keir Starmer to make the same mistakes he made in 2003, but which he denies were mistakes. The original decision to lead Britain to war, which was framed by George W. Bush, remember, as a retaliation in part against the September the 11th terror attacks on New York City. An event that prompted Donald Trump to lie that one of his own buildings had now become the tallest building in New York as a consequence of the World Trade Center being razed to the ground. Again, I do it a lot at the moment. We had a bit of a period where we weren't hitting these marks. We're talking about other things. I hope we return to that soon, if nothing else, for the sake of the people in the Middle East that will be dead soon if things don't stop. But Donald Trump responded to the World Trade Center attacks, to the September 11th terror attacks, by phoning a television station and boasting, lying, by the way, that one of his buildings in New York was now the tallest because the World Trade Center had previously been. It was downtown Manhattan that he was talking about. And someone reminded me of that the other day. And I thought, no, that must be one of those myths that grew up around him. No one can be that crass. No one can be that hideous, claiming that his building would now become the tallest in downtown Manhattan, and even that wasn't true. So crass, hideous, and horrific, if he was telling the truth, but he was lying. And this is the bloke that Tony Blair thinks we should be following into war. We played the clip, I think, last week. I think we did. I've certainly listened to it. Well, maybe we should play it again in case you don't believe me. But since when would you not believe me? So we got up to 5 on the Chilcot checklist. 6 is policy and strategy. Hands up if you think Donald Trump can answer this question. What does success look like? What does success look like? Does a clear strategy and a feasible course of action that will meet policy objectives exist? Is the approach supported by analysis? What do you reckon? Donald Trump has undertaken or has a clear strategy and a feasible course of action that will meet policy objectives? You reckon that? I mean, you'd have to, of course, accommodate the fact that all of his senior regime members have been offering up entirely alternative and even contradictory accounts of why they're doing it. So we're up to 6 on the Chilcot checklist. And so far, Starmer has observed all of them and Trump has observed none of them. In 7, what do we need to deliver? What are the resource implications of your options? Do you think they've thought about that? Starmer doesn't have to answer these questions, of course, because he hasn't gone into war. But they will all be part of the reason why he hasn't. What do you think the resource implications of the options are? Notice the price of oil yet, have you? Price of petrol going up, energy bills going up, all of these things. Donald Trump will be fine. Tony Blair will be fine. It's the rest of us that might not be. 8, planning and doing. How should we do it? Have you planned for a range of possible contingencies? Who is accountable and responsible for what? 10 million quid, 7 years, 12 volumes, Chilcot Inquiry, key lessons. 8, how should we do it? Have you planned for a range of possible contingencies? Do you think the man who accidentally killed the people that he was planning to put in charge had planned for a range of possible contingencies, or the man who insisted that the son of the old Ayatollah would definitely not be the new Ayatollah shortly before the son of the old Ayatollah became the new Ayatollah? Do you think he'd planned for a range of possible contingencies? 9, how will you monitor performance? This in many ways is the most interesting. Policy performance. How will you measure and evaluate success or failure? Spoiler alert, they won't. They won't. Look at, how do you measure our success? How do you measure and evaluate success and failure of the 2020 United States of America election? See? I warned you about this last week. He will claim a victory even if he suffers one of the most hideous and humiliating defeats in the history of warfare. How will you measure and evaluate success or failure? We won't. We will claim victory. We will be like a pigeon playing chess. We will poop all over the board, knock over all the pieces and strut around claiming that we've won. That's just a given. That's just a given. And then number 10, evaluation. Is the policy working? When and how will you review this policy? Has the context changed? That is, of course, what happened in a 24-hour window last weekend when Keir Starmer answered these questions. Has the context changed? Yes. Because the next question is, have UK objectives and interests changed? To which Keir Starmer said, yes. They've launched a drone, or someone has launched a drone, someone adjacent to the Iranian regime has launched a drone towards a British airbase in Cyprus. They are attacking our allies. The context has changed. Do you need to change direction? And Keir Starmer responded by saying, yes, a bit. We're not joining the war, the attack on Iran, but we will facilitate and contribute to attacks upon the ordnance or the facilities and installations that are attacking us and our allies. 10 points on the Chilcot checklist. Now, I don't know whether anyone at the Daily Telegraph has read this. I don't know whether anybody at the Daily Mail has ever read this. When the Daily Mail were constructing front pages using the Chilcot inquiry to attack Tony Blair, I don't know if they'd actually read it. I don't know if they were aware of the Chilcot checklist, the 10 things you're supposed to do in these kind of moments precisely to avoid a repetition of what happened in Iraq. And that was the point of the Chilcot inquiry. I go on all the time about the hypocrisy, the fraudulence, the moral corruption of these people. But it's rarely in letters quite so huge. This was designed to stop it from happening again. And they're all not only ignoring it, but they're calling for it to happen again. And Tony Blair has joined in. And we're supposed to be answering the question of why. Why has Tony Blair joined in? 10 minutes after 11 is the time. Hazel is in Angus. Hazel, what would you like to say?
Good morning, Dean.
Hello, Hazel.
I had to go run downstairs and get another phone because my battery ran out waiting for you.
Can we clip that up and use it as an ad? Can we clip that up and use it as an advert, please, Keith? Carry on, Hazel.
What I'd like to say is the reason, or one reason, I think that answers the question of why Tony Blair is doing what he's doing is because Tony Blair's institute is largely funded by some very rich Americans.
Yes.
Just as Reform UK is. And I think that's where you might look for an answer. I mean, all the other things are probably true as well about vanity, etc. But I think you've got to look there. These people are pulling the strings all over the place.
I can't really criticise you, can I? Because it's a bit Occam's razory. Is you just suggesting that we follow the money? And this organisation is huge, isn't it? And it never seems to have turned down a potential client on the grounds of unsuitability involved in some regimes that are suboptimal, are far from admirable. And he is just doing what his bankrollers want him to do. I don't know. I mean, you could be right. That's the one thing we'll never prove. It's a little bit close to conspiracy, isn't it? But you'd need to come up with a better explanation in order to take Hazel's off the board. I think I prefer the psychology of it. If he rejects the findings of Chilcot, then he kind of has to encourage Starmer to do what he did in 2003, because that way the culpability of his course is covered up, is excused, is diluted.
The power of money to make people forget things,
yeah,
is just, I mean, it's terrifying what I'm reading about.
And you believe it, don't you? So I was thinking about this in the context of journalists earlier. I was talking to Eleanor about people I used to work with who were decent, nice people, and who have gone absolutely bonkers. Who I don't just mean the ones that went to work for GBBs. I mean some of the ones who are working for print organs now, who are calling for this war in complete ignorance of everything that happened in 2003, the Chilcot inquiry into what happened in 2003, and the obvious sagacity of public opinion. And they actually believe it. It's not just the money. Even normal people need to pay the bills. And you're doing a job working somewhere that is as morally corrupt as the Daily Mail. And after 2 or 3 years, you've become complicit. It's like Stockholm Syndrome. So maybe that world he lives in has boiled his brain.
If you think of all these billionaires, like the leaders of Amazon, etc., who swarm around Trump.
Yeah.
Now, do they really believe his policies, or do they just seek power? And it's just permeating societies all over the West.
Well, we know the answer to that question, and the tragedy is that when they were actually on the right side of humanity, when they were in favour of diverse workforces and health and safety legislation and trying to make workplaces more palatable for women and all of those exercises and ideas that were supposed to improve the human experience, they were all on board with it until they didn't have to be anymore, and then they couldn't get out of that space quick enough, could they? Before you go, quick game. Who said this? Are you ready?
Yes.
Was it A, Fozzie Bear? Was it B, Mr. Blobby? Or was it C, Daniel Hannan? All right, are you ready?
Yes.
We have suffered our worst national humiliation since the Suez debacle, if not the fall of Singapore. This time, though, we lack the excuse of having been pressured by allies or attacked by foes. The decision to cower and plead neutrality, even a Fozzie Bear, Mr. Blobby, or the world's wrongest man, Daniel, of course, now, thanks to Boris Johnson, Lord Hannan, to me and you.
The Brexit-loving Lord Hannan, I would say.
Brexit-loving Lord Hannan. COVID isn't going to kill you. Nobody is talking about leaving the single market. And we have suffered our worst national humiliation since the Suez debacle. At least he's consistent.
This is LBC.
British Gas have this thing. We call it home care. We'll fix all sorts, and it's unlimited repairs. Expert engineers will solve the upset of boilers not boiling or taps that won't wet. Electrics playing tricks, or a pipe that's broke. We're there for everyone, even blue furry folk. Your home won't feel booby-trapped. It'll feel just like new. British Gas, taking care of things and looking after you. T's and C's apply. Excess options available per repair.
From rusty chains to fancy frames and everything in between. Sign up for British Heart Foundation's iconic London to Brighton bike ride. Because it's not your wheels, it's how you use them. Whether you're a brand new rider or seasoned pro, challenge yourself this June and make your ride matter with British Heart Foundation. And you won't need any fancy gear, just your helmet and your bike. Sign up today, search London to Brighton Bike Ride and keep us beating.
I'm JJ Chalmers, and I'm going up and down the country to find out how UK government defence investment is creating opportunities for local people right on their doorsteps. With millions injected into traditional industries, we're seeing how pride and progress are coming together to shape the UK's future for real people. From Scotland to Sheffield, it's creating opportunities that will help support communities for generations to come. This is the UK, and we make it here.
James O'Brien on LBC. Call 0345 6060973.
16 minutes after 11, we may rehabilitate Tom in Barcelona. I didn't understand the point that he was making. Lisa suggests that what he was simply saying was that he will look better if Starmer does what he did, then it will let him off the hook, or I don't think he was saying that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It does matter, but it doesn't matter. I sound like Donald Trump now. Martin's in Belfast to answer the question of why Tony Blair has weighed into probably illegal war in the Middle East on the side that you might, having read the Chilcot inquiry or having any memory of what happened the last time he went to war in the Middle East, you might have thought he'd have come down on the other side, but he hasn't. He's Team Trump. Martin, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. When I heard this on the radio the other day, I actually had to pull over and buy some Gaviscon. It gave me this sick feeling in my mouth. This man has no credence in anything to do with the Gulf States, and his only credence is with the people who were the cheerleaders for Iraq, and he seems happy for the hearses to return to Royal Wooten Bassett.
Being very poetic and passionate, and I like that, but It doesn't. I'm looking for it to make sense rather than just that visceral repulsion at what he's done, which I fully appreciate. And I feel some of it. It's like, how dare you? But if you could read his mind, what would we find?
I'm not a psychologist, but him having been appointed to this Trump's peace panel or whatever it is, he seems to think that he's still able to add something, and he thinks the whole of the UK has become amnesic. I think he's still trying to clutch on to, yes, I did some things wrong, but I did loads of things right, and if you can let me be relevant still, I can add something to this
possible mess. This is, takes us back to Cathy and Axminster, and I mean, vanity is a very powerful drug, isn't it? And that idea of... But he could... I mean, imagine if he'd come out and backed Keir Starmer. He'd still have all of the trappings of importance and attention, and he'd be, I think, not only on the same side as public opinion, but probably, and of course nothing's ever cast in stone, probably on the right side of history as well.
But that would risk his position on the peace committee.
He'd be straight off the board of peace, wouldn't he?
He'd be straight onto the reserves bench.
And he wouldn't be helping in the reconstruction of Gaza, whatever that is.
Whatever he might get out of that, he's still hoping to have some sort of inkling of clearing his name before he passes on.
How does he clear his name? Just run me through this again, because this is the point I'm missing repeatedly. He clears his name because if Starmer does it, it makes what he did less bad.
But it won't, but that's what I'm saying.
No, but that's what he's thinking.
That's what he's trying to think. Well, I can get a few points back here and maybe...
And that's what Tom in Barcelona was saying. Is that what Tom in Barcelona was saying earlier as well? Because we're speculating on his thinking, not on what is likely or unlikely to happen. But he thinks that if Starmer does roughly what he did, then he looks historically less bad.
Oh yeah, it's spread the blame.
You look at what all the right wing tub thumpers are doing, and they're all calling for war, just like they did with Iraq. And that's where I begin to get confused, because I'm not quite sure who he's trying to curry favour with. But maybe it's his own soul. Maybe it's his own conscience. Is that I will feel better about the awful things that I did if Keir Starmer does them too.
He's also a renowned lawyer, so he'd say, look, well, I maybe got that bit wrong, but like the next prime minister, who is a lawyer,
he knows
he's probably Starmer's going to end up the same place he does, but he's trying to push him down that to say, look, well, we can all make mistakes.
I can't have a go at people, can I, for filling up the vacuum that I spend about nearly half an hour describing at the top of today's show, because everything is valid in a way. I think we started saying this during COVID. That's where the vacuum theory first popped up, is that if government leaves a vacuum, if they don't tell us and they don't demonstrate any sort of plan, which takes us back to Chilcot, number 8, planning and doing, how should we do it? If they're not telling us what they're doing or why or how, then we speculate. Tony Blair's never going to tell us why he thinks Keir Starmer should join Benjamin Netanyahu. I mean, supremely untroubled by genocide, I think, is a label that we can apply to Tony Blair in his dealings, but he's supremely untroubled by all manner of political aberrations and horror shows. If you look at the clientele for his foundation, and if indeed you look at the personnel he sits alongside with on Donald Trump's board of peas. But that idea that he get into the weeds of his thinking, and if Starmer does it, then history will be kinder to me. Or even my own conscience will be kinder to me if Starmer does it. So you cling to this thing. I don't know what the maddest thing is that you believe. She'll come back to me one day. Or it wasn't my fault. They need us more than we need them. I don't know what the maddest thing. There is a good Brexit, but it goes to a different school. What's the hardest thing? So in your heart of hearts, you know you're wrong. Events have proved you wrong. Brexit's probably quite a good one. You can't let go of it. So imagine if, this analogy might not work, and it's all on me, it's nothing to do with Martin, but imagine if, I don't know, Meloni in Italy decided to take Italy out of the European Union. Instead of saying, don't do it, it's been an absolute disaster for us, you'd encourage them to do it. Oh, this is good. This is it. I think I'm getting there now. So you would encourage, as one of the people who still thinks Brexit could have gone well, bless you, would you like to buy a bridge? You see another country planning it, and instead of saying to them, don't do it, it's a disaster, you go, yes, someone else is doing it, I don't look that stupid anymore. And in Blair's case, it's I don't look that morally corrupt anymore. I don't look that ridiculous. I don't look that wrong. I don't look that horrible. And it's what you see in the mirror. So you, the Brexiter, and yes, I can bring Brexit into everything. It's because I'm a Brexit genius. You look in the mirror and you see the idiot who believed Farage. In fact, you might still be the idiot that believes Farage because he's still doing quite well in the polls. Did I tell you what happened to him this weekend? Flew all the way to Florida to meet Donald Trump. Didn't meet Donald Trump. Bless him. You look in the mirror and you see the idiot who voted for Brexit, right? And rather than saying to everybody else over there who is about to vote for Brexit in a different era, in a different country, in a different context, rather saying, please learn from my mistakes, your ego pushes you to applaud and encourage them because then you'll feel a bit less stupid. Oh, the stakes here are much greater than stupidity. Tony Blair has blood on his hands. But if Keir Starmer makes the same mistake, it looks less like a mistake, and I don't see the haunted eyes looking back at me from the mirror that I currently see every morning, because Keir Starmer, Mr. Righteous, the international lawyer, the man who explained why Iraq was wrong in 2003, he has gone in on this. So the eyes looking back at me are a little less haunted now. That's why he wants Starmer to do it. Is that... That's not what Tommy... But Tom in Barcelona is benefiting from the most extraordinary rehabilitation, just because I'm so generous and kind. But that's not what he was saying at all. But it is where Martin has led me, and it's got something in it, right? It's got something in it. 24 minutes after 11 is the time. More on Farage's adventures in the United States a little later in the programme from Henry Riley during the Reform Watch or the Farage Files or whatever you prefer to call it. And, of course, it is Online Safety Day today. All day on LBC, myself and my colleagues looking at stories that have a particular relevance to the online world. And I'll be joined before the end of this hour by Alex Tate from an organisation that you have heard of, or at least I've brought to your attention before, called Reform Political Advertising, looking at all manner of things that will probably surprise you, but also something a colleague of mine, Flaminia Luck, has been writing about on the LBC website, the horrors of fake videos, bogus videos featuring real politicians saying and doing things that they have never said or done. And one of the things Alex is calling for is a ban on deepfake technologies and deepfake films in the context of political figures. 25 minutes after 11 is the time. Farah is in Southfields. Farah, what would you like to say?
Can I just say thank you so much for having Victoria Rose on last week. Also,
well, thank you for telling me. Thank you for telling me that I should have got Victoria Rose on last week, because it was your intervention that prompted Eleanor and I to get in touch with her. Actually, Farah.
Yeah, thank you so much to both of you. Right, Tony Blair.
Yes.
I think he's a coward, a fool, and totally disingenuous. A coward because he didn't have the balls to actually say this to Starmer or say it publicly.
We don't know that.
Okay, well, a fool because, again, I was just going to say, his comments were always going to get out. And
yeah,
also disingenuous because his apology, obviously, in Parliament meant nothing. And the other thing is nobody should be paying any attention to him because he's a failed Middle East envoy. That border peace is going well, don't you think? And
are you suggesting that an organisation that has Viktor Orban in the front line as well as the Prime Minister of Bulgaria, well, I don't know enough about Bulgaria to comment on that, but you're suggesting that they are not the single most important assembly of world leaders in the history of the known world?
Well, of course, and the Arab countries who actually joined all of that, but they feel a little bit silly now, given that being bombed.
Yes, that's a very good point.
Every 5 seconds.
Yes.
And, you know, what I've heard is that they're going to disallow the Americans from using their US bases in the future because part of the trade-off was to protect them.
Well, Cyprus don't want even our base there anymore, according to one report this morning, because all it does is paint a target on their back the next time a mad American president marches into war with a genocidal Israeli.
I think the other thing is that he's probably incredibly jealous about the support that Starmer is getting.
Do you think he would be that? I mean, he won 3 elections. I mean, I don't know. Ego's a fascinating thing. But do you think that that might come into it? That he thinks, flipping heck, Starmer's going to get it right and I got it wrong. Therefore, I'm going to encourage Starmer to get it wrong.
I think he's just thinking about himself. And also, you know, towards the end, he wasn't hugely popular. I've always been a Labour supporter, and I didn't vote for him for any of those elections. And I was quite young.
Really?
And I I'm almost 50, so it was a while ago. Mm-hmm. And I watched the Iraq War sort of come out, you know, burst out on TV. I was in Cuba at the time, and there were Americans there because they go through Canada to get there. And they were just horrified.
Yeah.
And my American friends are saying exactly the same thing. In fact, one of them actually texted me, must have been the middle of the night for him, and he said, what's Tony Blair doing? I mean, you know, there is nothing but humiliation for this man ahead. And he's completely disingenuous. His legacy is poor because of the Iraq War. And I'm sure Starmer is thinking, I certainly don't want to be thought that way. He's not the best politician, but he's certainly an excellent international lawyer. And he's got to stick to his guns. I'm sure his poll numbers are going up.
He's sticking to Chilcot. That's the bit that makes me despair for my own profession, is that, you know, it just highlights that even when they were reporting Chilcot with great fanfare and detail, they were interested in it only because it was a stick with which they could beat Tony Blair. Because now they're using Tony Blair and his ignorance and rejection of Chilcot as a stick with which to beat Keir Starmer. It's almost as if they don't care about the quality of policy, the caliber of character, or the integrity of individuals. If they wear a red rosette, they're toast. They're fair game, they're a target, regardless of the national interest, the international repercussions, or the truth, Farah.
I think the other thing is that Tony Blair just ignored what public opinion said the last time during the Iraq War. And I would say for the first time, Keir Starmer has read the room properly. He's seen the reaction from all of us. Right now, you know, legally he's in the right place. Who knows what will happen in the future, but right now he is. And, you know, he's turning my head. I didn't vote for him last time for lots of different reasons, but he's turning my head. And I just have hope that if he continues to go down and show integrity and real leadership, you know, I think he's got, you know, a better chance at the
For sure. And you know what's quite refreshing? I hadn't thought about this until you started talking. There is no planet on which Keir Starmer is doing what he's doing for political gain.
No, not at all, I mean, you can see how Donald Trump has reacted.
Yeah, there's no conversation in which they've said, well, this will poll well, or this could be our Falklands, or this could be our... He just looks at Chilcot, looks at international law, and, you know, Chilcot has improved upon the context in which the decision to go to war in Iraq was made, and he just does the sums, he does the calculations, and he arrives at these conclusions. We can't get involved in that. The original attacks, the unprovoked attacks upon Iran, but we can get involved in that, the attempts to stymie their ability to attack us and our allies, even though it's in response to an unprovoked, probably illegal war. They're two completely different contexts, and he gets it. He could have done a slightly better job of explaining that, but he's got quite a lot on his plate at the moment, hasn't he?
I think he also has to be quite careful in the way that he expresses himself, and I do think that was a bit of a Love Actually moment, you know,
yeah,
last week.
I think it might be.
So, you know, I'm all behind him.
Unless you are willfully and deliberately ignoring Chilcot, having pretended that it really, really mattered when you were using it as a stick with which to beat Tony Blair, I don't see how you can be anything other than in favour of the course that Keir Starmer has followed. A little further detail on the Tony Blair motivations. Larry Ellison, or at least the Larry Ellison Foundation, which is the personal foundation of the guy that owns Oracle and a big, big Trump supporter. Isn't he about to buy another media outlet in the United States as well? Is he on one of those? I don't know. They're moving around like toast at the minute. They have donated, the Larry Ellison Foundation has donated or pledged at least £257 million to the Tony Blair Institute, which is a phenomenal figure. 900 staff, 45 countries, levels of funding that UK think tanks, because it is technically a think tank, albeit that unlike all the ones that you have heard of, it discloses its funding, can only dream of. There it is. A turnover in 2023 of $145.3 million. So you get an indication there of just how much heft Larry Ellison, the owner of Oracle, brings to this particular table. A New Statesman have looked into it. So have the newsroom's Lighthouse Reports and Democracy for sale in the past. It might be worth digging some of that up again now. In fact, I think I shared Peter Gagan's piece about this on Blue Sky on Saturday. 11:32 is the time. Two lots of guests for you next, taking us up to 12 o'clock. Is Henry Reilly a guest? Not technically, but he's always good value, so we'll let him into the studio. And then at 12 o'clock, back to the phone-in proper, although Natasha Devon will be joining us at 1:30 as part of Online Safety Day. I'm tempted to ask what the King should do. I'll just give you a heads up on that so that we can hit the ground running at 12 noon. The King is due to make a state visit to the United States of America next month. Not next year, not next, I don't know, February, next month. And here are his options. He goes and uses it to tweak Donald Trump's nose. He goes and behaves as if everything is perfectly normal. He doesn't go and pulls a sickie. Technical term for you there. And goodness knows the man's health battles are considerable at the moment, so nobody would argue or indeed raise an eyebrow if it was announced that he's just not quite up to the trip at the moment. Or he says he can't possibly go because Donald Trump is clearly an enemy of our country. Or words, perhaps, to that effect, but milder. Those are your four options. If you've got another option, give me a quick heads up. And then at 12 o'clock, we'll have a chat about what we think he should do and why. Here's Dominic Ellis with your headlines.
Sir Keir Starmer says protecting households from rising costs will be a priority as the Iran conflict pushes up oil prices. Markets have dipped sharply after Brent crude climbed above $100 a barrel for the first time since 2022. The internet regulator insists fines for companies failing to keep children safe online are acting as a deterrent. A year after the Online Safety Act came in, LBC has found that Ofcom's issued more than £3 million worth of penalties, but only 55,000 of that has been paid. And Network Rail says Glasgow Central Station will remain closed today and likely remain shut on Tuesday following a nearby fire. Services aren't stopping there after the fire broke out in a vape shop. LBC weather, cloudy but dry for most. Some patchy rain for the west, a high of 15 degrees.
This is LBC.
Jay here knows that Zoopla can provide valuations for any home in the UK. So we can see what that new couple across the road might have paid.
Ooh la la.
Have a nose at what the curtain twitchers next door could sell for. And even see what his own place is worth.
Cool, look at that.
Plus, Zoopla lets you find and compare local estate agents if you do decide to sell up. Think of all those new neighbours you'll be able to snoop on, Jay. If you want to know, just ask Zoopla.
Sorry to interrupt your day, but I've just been diagnosed with dementia, and I'm going to need your help. I'll need help when I can no longer button a shirt or recognise my own family. My daughter will need help too. I worry this could ruin her life. And we will all need help to find a cure to end the devastation of dementia. I can't do this alone.
It will take a society to beat dementia. Alzheimer's Society.
My name's Mark, and this is my NHS story. The sensation in my neck was painful all the time. Once I spoke to my GP, they referred me to my CDC. They got me in very, very quickly. The amount of pain I went through for something so easy, why hadn't I done this 4 months before?
The government is opening new community diagnostic centres, with many already available 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, so the NHS can be there for all of us when we need it. Find your closest one at gov.uk/NHS Fit for the Future. Available England-wide.
Get 3 months half price when you switch to an unlimited SIM with Three. That means quick streaming, faster downloads, and more money to spend on the things you love. Join the UK's fastest 5G network and get your unlimited SIM today. Buy now in store or see 3.co.uk.
Unlimited 24-month light plan. Proof of switching required. Based on Ookla speed test intelligence data 2H2025. All rights reserved. Subject to credit checks and terms.
This is LBC with James O'Brien. Call 0345 60 973. Text 84850. Alexa, send a comment to LBC.
11:37 is the time. Oh, crikey, I was very late for the last junction, so Henry Riley's opportunities to bring us up to date with everything that's going on in Farage land or Reform UK territory is in danger of being curtailed. To wit, I shall be quiet and open the floor to you, Henry. Where are you going to start?
Well, I'll be quick. There are eight options. You've got local or national, James. Do you have a preference as to where you go first?
Let's start local. Okay, local stories for local people.
Let's go first to Staffordshire, and Chris Large, who... It's a big story. He's now sitting as an independent councillor, and they've declined Reform UK to say why he's no longer in the party. To remind you, there was a leader in Staffordshire. They got removed for allegedly racist comments. Chris Large was then installed as leader, voted in as the leader. He quit a few days later due to a family bereavement, but it then turns out he was also under fire for alleged racist activity.
What? A Reform UK councillor? Allegedly racist activity? Whatever next.
TikTok account appeared in his name, appeared to like a comment about the Deputy Prime Minister David Lammy, calling him a thoroughbred and very sort of uncomfortable comments.
A greedy non-thoroughbred.
Spelt
wrong, inevitably.
And he claimed that his TikTok account was shared among many others, but he's out of Reform.
They won't tell us why.
They won't tell us why.
Mm. Is it anything to do with Bernard Manning?
Nothing to do with Bernard Manning.
Oh, you say that. We'll see. National.
Okay. The Chagos stunt, if you want to call it that, has been linked now to a Reform mega donor in the name of Christopher Harborne.
Oh, yes.
This is Nigel Farage's attempts to reach the Chagos Islands military base. Mr Harborne has donated £12 million to Reform UK.
How much?
£12 million to Reform UK.
Whoa.
He donated, there's a £9 million
based in Thailand,
gift.
I think, is he?
Last summer. He does have links to Thailand.
Yeah.
He donated a further £3 million to Reform in the last quarter of last year. It was revealed last week. He has links to the plane that flew Mr. Farage to the Maldives, and that flew the Chagossian campaigners who are now on Ile de Quoir, but they were flown out initially to Sri Lanka. And Mr. Farage also accepted a £28,000 donation from Mr. Harborne to attend Donald Trump's inauguration. So he's a sort of long-standing donor to the party.
How did he make his money?
I haven't got those exact details in front of me, but...
I just wondered.
Yeah.
I wonder if cryptocurrency is involved.
It's to do with cryptocurrency,
Is it?
He has links to cryptocurrency,
okay.
Yes.
Okay. International.
International. Let's go to... Yes, Donald Trump. In fact, let me tell you, Nigel Farage, speaking of Chagossians, linking the two, Nigel Farage was at a Guido Fawkes Save Chagos... Yes, run by Lord Kempsall. They were a Save Chagos party on a boat, and Nigel Farage spoke.
President Trump has almost understood the deal. Almost. But I will be dining at Mar-a-Lago tomorrow night. Reinforce the message.
Uh-huh. Going to Mar-a-Lago.
Listen to the cheering as well. Who are these? Was that a working men's club in South Shields?
No, that was a boat in central London.
But all the people there were like welders and dockers and coal miners.
I don't know the attendee. It was held by Guido Fawkes. I'm not sure of the attendees.
The man of the people. It was upholding working class. It was in Clacton, was it, the boat?
No, the boat was, I think it was Vauxhall Way, actually.
Oh, should we just listen to that again? Because it sounded to me like they were serving jelly deals and having a right old knees up to knees up Mother Brown.
President Trump has almost understood the deal. Almost. But I will be dining at Mar-a-Lago tomorrow night. And will reinforce the message.
Uh-huh.
Up the apples and pears. What happened when he met Trump?
Oh, he didn't meet Donald Trump at the end. He went to the Mar-a-Lago residence on Friday.
Who paid for that
and
flight?
We don't know at this stage. But he had obviously given that impression he was going to meet Donald Trump. It turns out he was invited by another member of the club, according to people briefed on the matter. This is reporting in the Financial Times. He had hoped to catch up with Donald Trump for a conversation because he was scheduled to travel to Mar-a-Lago. However, there was a change in Donald Trump's itinerary and he instead stayed in Doral, which is around an hour away.
So he flew all the way to Florida to meet Donald Trump and didn't meet Donald Trump.
I'm sure Reform would say he was there to further links with others in the Trump administration.
Bernard Manning!
Is that an invitation for another story?
Yeah.
Yeah. Can I talk to you about flags? This is Nottingham. In fact, let me play you. This was an exchange outside Nottinghamshire Council from their leader, Mick Barton.
75 grand on flags in the car park resurfaced.
Right.
It looks really good. That's the priorities reform made.
It's absolute nonsense. We've run out of money.
Yeah, because you spent it on flags.
Your government, 14 years.
You spent it on flags.
24 years, right? 24 years. The roads haven't had enough funding. 24 years. That's why they're all shot, right? It's never been done before. When I say game, don't interrupt.
Just don't interrupt.
Because
this is for the public.
I'm explaining.
Is that this week or April? Because you said on BBC Radio last week that it was from this week. The people need to know.
It is happening from this week.
Well, it's not on the roads of West Midford that I walked on yesterday to report potholes that went out with iPhones.
We've got 2,000.
So was you right on BBC Radio or are you right now? Tell the truth.
I'm right all time. So go away. Right.
Say stuff and then the reality is completely different.
Well, I said to you in the
chamber, 1,000 potholes could have been done with the flag money.
Shut up about the flags, he says.
How much did they spend on flags?
Well, £75,000 on 164 Union Jack banners around the county.
Why? There's a bunch of racists doing it for free.
He previously said that the cost would be offset by businesses who would sponsor the flags going up.
And how's that going?
That hasn't proven to be particularly fruitful at this stage.
If a business wants to put a flag up, a business can put a flag up.
He was being challenged by a Conservative councillor, by the way, James. Yeah. And as you heard there, it was about potholes. And yes, £75,000. But he said to shut up about the flags.
Hmm. And he's the leader of the council, is he?
He's the leader, Mick Barton.
Nottinghamshire
County Council.
Good
yes.
God. Is that it?
There's a few more. Are you local or national?
Let's talk a bit more about Bitcoin. Because I think we need to keep a close eye on Bitcoin. Because one of the things we underestimate about what's happening in the United States of America is this. I mean, they even launched their own Bitcoin, didn't they? And then they launched a Bitcoin in Mrs. Trump's name. And some people have made some enormous sums of money. And the people who are in the business of making enormous sums of money want politicians in power so that they can tweak or indeed revolutionize Bitcoin legislation. So I'm always interested by the relationship between right-wing politicians, because they're usually right-wing, and Bitcoin. What have you found?
Well, this is reporting, again, credit to the Financial Times, who first reported this today. Nigel Farage has taken a stake in a Bitcoin company, Stack Bitcoin. Their executive chairman is Kwasi Kwarteng, the former Conservative Chancellor. Nivster Farage, through his media company, Thorn in the Side Limited, has invested £215,000 in Stack Bitcoin.
Think of all the flags he could have bought.
Yeah, it's the first public funding of a crypto business by the reform leader, who is trying to strengthen his ties with the industry. They announced it, as I say, today. He's been announced as a strategic investor for Stack Bitcoin. Mr. Kwarteng, who, of course, you know, best known for his month as Chancellor, has a 5.4% shareholder. That includes shares with his wife. He's the executive chair. And, of course, this all relating to Reform UK, who've previously said they will start accepting donations in cryptocurrency.
Bitcoin. So, Kwasi Kwarteng's disastrous budget, of course, described by Nigel Farage as the best in living memory or similar. So, perhaps not that surprising, but I've said it before and I'll say it again. Watch the crypto relationship with right-wing or far-right politicians. What about the others? I mean, it's hard to keep up. Who's in and who's out? So I'd like to think that Richard Tice, and who got his backside handed to him in a bucket by Lewis Goodall on LBC yesterday, although bless him, Richard Tice, probably not bright enough to realise that he's being handed his backside in a bucket. And honest Bob Jenrick, unless I've gone bonkers, seem to be pursuing polar opposite policies on the war in Iran, despite ostensibly being part of the same party.
And they've been accused of being in an almighty mess by the Labour Party, differing positions. Let me tell you, this was Robert Jenrick, who is now the party's Treasury spokesperson. They call him Shadow Chancellor. He was speaking on the BBC.
We don't see a cause for the UK to be deploying our personnel, such as airmen, offensively in bombing raids over Iran. As far as I'm aware, we've not been asked to do that.
You compare that with Richard Tice, the deputy leader, who was speaking in Dubai on Al Arabiya.
Would you be seeing the RAF bomb Iran?
We would be helping the Americans and the Israelis in any way they saw appropriate, because this is a strategic, permanent threat to all of our safety and interests. And look, obviously, the Americans have the greatest military resources. We all know that. But if requests were made, we would have been saying, yes, we're pleased to help.
So, yes, we are pleased to help, was the line from Richard Tice, the deputy leader. Robert Jenrick, another senior figure in the party, as you heard then, struck a rather more cautious tone, saying the Brits didn't want to get involved.
He really went a bit further than that. Didn't he say we would do whatever they wanted us to do?
Yes.
So what just... Remind us what sovereignty is, would you?
Well, he said, we'd be helping the Americans and Israelis in any way they saw appropriate.
Right.
If requests were made, we would have been saying, yes, we are pleased to help.
And what's sovereignty again?
I'm sure you have a much more coherent definition.
Well, more coherent than that lot. But the idea that you just, when a foreign power says jump, you just shout how high as loud as you can, despite... Well, it's all very interesting. That's about eight stories, is it?
Well, I have one... Well, that's six. I have one line on two more.
Yeah, go on.
Very quickly. Reform UK under fire for selling Kent County Council artwork. Most of the pieces valued at a few hundred pounds. The Green parties have said that they shouldn't be selling paintings, drawings,
and these would be pictures of locally relevant... Seems.
Yes, exactly. They've got a combined value of 80 grand, and the council have said they will sell it to raise funds.
For flags?
Unclear as of yet. And lastly, a Reform UK councillor who's now defected to Restore, which is another right-wing party, that's Rupert Lowe's party,
right,
has said he was suspended over a row about clipboards. Councillor Eardley has been accused of misappropriating branch assets after losing track of six clipboards which were purchased for his by-election campaign, which he won. Reform UK said he was suspended for being aggressive towards a female volunteer, but he claims it was regarding clipboards.
Well, I mean, what a time to be alive.
Thanks, James.
Thanks, Henry. That was eight stories. It's only Monday. Are you off? Are you around all week?
I'm around tomorrow, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, see if we get double figures on a single day. I mean, what would we do without them? It's 11:48.
LBC. This morning on Nick Ferrari at Breakfast.
Dame Melanie Dawes. Now, she's the chief executive for the boss at Ofcom. It's the job of her and her colleagues to investigate big tech companies who fail to comply with online safety laws.
What's the amount that has been levied in fines?
It's over £3 million.
And of those £3 million, how much has actually been paid? How much has Ofcom...
We've had one fine paid so far.
Satisfied are you with that?
I think the important thing about fines is the deterrent message that they send.
Let's bring into the conversation an online safety campaigner, Ellen Room, who sadly lost her teenage son.
As a parent, you have no legal right to see what your children look at online. So I started campaigning for something called Jules Law, which is going through, and Liz Kendall, the Secretary of State, told me that that will be passed. So when a child dies, their online data will be saved.
Why is that important to you?
Because there was nothing found offline, so what on earth happened to him? None of the social media companies would give me his browsing data or his messages. If they had nothing to hide, why would they not hand it over?
Nick Ferrari at Breakfast. Back tomorrow morning from 7. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
Tesco Insurance are driving down the cost of motoring with 10% off car insurance. Take out a car insurance policy before the 15th of May 2026 and you'll get 10% off with club card prices. We offer a range of cover options so you can choose the one that's right for you. Save 10% when you buy or renew a car policy with Tesco Insurance. Search Tesco Car Insurance and get a quote direct today. Club card required. Excludes add-ons. T's and C's apply.
At TfL, we're helping make roads safer. We're continuing to roll out lower speed limits because 20 miles per hour roads have already seen 24% fewer collisions causing death or serious injury. We're also improving junctions to help keep you safe and improving visibility for our bus drivers with new wing mirror cameras. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Comparison of collisions data before and after implementation of 20 miles per hour speed limit.
Get 3 months half price when you switch to an unlimited SIM with Three. That means quick streaming, faster downloads, and more money to spend on the things you love. Join the UK's fastest 5G network and get your unlimited SIM today. Buy now in store or see 3.co.uk.
Unlimited 24-month light plan. Proof of switching required. Based on Ookla Speed Test Intelligence data 2H 2025. All rights reserved. Subject to credit checks and terms.
Thanks for the key deliverables, David. Now, who'd like to...
Stay out all night! Yahoo!
That's brilliant. So, OK, sales targets. Are we hitting...
Hit the dance floor!
There's more than one you, and with Specsavers 2 for 1, you can choose glasses for at least two yous. From £70 with standard single vision lenses.
Nice moves, David!
Book an appointment at specsavers.co.uk. Conditions apply.
Right,
Who's all in for Cancer Research UK's Race for Life?
Sunday Leaguers! Dog lovers! Bait cubbers! Banker dancers! Baby ravers! Potters!
Whether you walk it, jog it, or run it, go all in against cancer. All in to help fund life-saving research.
Sign up to your local 3K, 5K, 10K or Pretty Muddy event from just £14.99. Search Race for Life. Prices vary by event distance and participant age.
James O'Brien on LBC.
I want to get a laminator. Have you got a laminator? Keith, is there a laminator in the building? I want to get these Chilcot checklist. I want to get it laminated because I'm going to come back to this again and again and again. And I'm such a child. Look at all the doodling I've done on. Can you see all the doodling I've done on? I can't do it. So I need a new one every day. Or can we get just all sorts of stuff? Clever stuff and silly stuff, but nothing that I'm embarrassed about having just held up to the camera, which means that people who were nosy could zoom in and see it. But can we get it laminated? 11:53 is the time. Alex Tate is here from Reform Political Advertising. And I said it last time you were here, but the audience keeps growing, Alex, so there'll be people listening who weren't here last time you were here. I could not believe it the first time it was explained to me that the regulation of advertising, for example, washing powder, is approximately 7 million times more rigorous than the regulation of advertising political parties. Hence, you're politically neutral not-for-profit, and that's crucial because everybody has been less than ideal in this kind of context, all the parties. You're campaigning for greater transparency and accuracy in election advertising, which means the Representation of the People Bill, which is about to hit committee stage in the House of Commons, is something that you have been following with particular interest.
That's right, yeah. And thanks for having me on, James.
Pleasure.
I don't think it's an overstatement to say it's a once-in-a-generation opportunity to do something about it, actually, with this going to committee stage. And the reason I think that's valid is that, actually, election laws haven't changed have barely changed in decades, and certainly the rules for election advertising hasn't. And actually, if you combine that with like some technological change that we're seeing at the moment, and actually the fragmentation of vote share into the five-party system that we're seeing at the moment with the rise of Reform and the Greens, we're seeing incredibly close election contests, like razor-thin victories, which makes this just ever more pressing. So I think MRS is projecting that a third of the constituency seats in 2026 are going to be marginal, so won by a 5% vote share or less.
Wow.
And actually, just to give you some examples of that, the Runcorn by-election was won by 6 votes. That was 0.02% of the vote share. The Doncaster mayoral election, Labour beat Reform by 698 votes. That's 1% of the vote share. The North Tyneside mayoral election that was particularly filled with disinformation, Labour just squeaked by with 440 votes. That was 0.8% of the vote share. So election ads, they're not the biggest driver of why someone votes, but with votes that close, can it have a decisive impact? Yes, and it will. And then you add to it, actually, as all of your viewers will be seeing, the sort of rise of AI and deepfakes. It just turbocharges the whole disinformation space. That means that it's urgent and a great opportunity to do something about this.
So bizarrely, and you kicked off in 2018, didn't you? And I think we spoke for the first time shortly afterwards. And
you more or less launched our campaign, James, honest.
We do our best, Alex. Yeah, we do our best. But things have actually got, and this isn't a criticism because things are moving and this bill is crucial, but things are now much worse because deepfakes and digital impersonation were things that we didn't even know about in 2018. You've seen the George Freeman story. Have you, that our colleague Flaminia has written up for the LBC website and Full Fact have looked into as well. This is a bloke, but to all intents and purposes, the former Conservative MP, George Freeman, on social media, on film, revealing that he has defected to Reform, which he actually hasn't. No crime committed, no offence committed.
And he couldn't do anything about it as well because there were no rules to prevent.
Couldn't even get them to take it down, or
yeah. So there were 4 things. We've kind of worked very closely actually with other democracy groups and people like Full Fact and an all party political group in Westminster called the Fair Elections APPG.
Yeah.
To have 4 recommendations, and that's one of them. George Freeman's example is a really good textbook example of why we're advocating that you shouldn't be able to impersonate a political candidate via deepfake or AI.
It's huge, isn't it?
Yeah.
Potentially, because you could have, I mean, I'm sure we already do, footage of somebody saying something absolutely hideous and being, you know, having it hung around their neck like an albatross, even though they never came close to making those comments or said anything vaguely similar.
I predict you're going to see, in the run-up to the May elections, this bill's certainly not going to be done by then. I predict we're going to see more and more of this. And I'm sure your listeners have started to see examples of that, actually, in TikTok and X. It's kind of increasingly...
And as we have discovered, particularly in the context of children's online safety, these platforms aren't going to do anything about it unless they absolutely have to, which is why we need laws and robust punishment. So to run through the four recommendations for the bill, you've got clear and prominent party identification. That's quite self-explanatory. A transparent, searchable database of all election adverts. Why is that so important?
It's to combat what people call dark advertising. So advertising that only the person that's targeted with it sees and that isn't open to public scrutiny. So it rose to prominence at the Brexit referendum as a sort of concept. And I think we were the first people to put this forward as a concept, as an independent database, in 2018 to the Fake News and Disinformation Inquiry. And, it's not a pipe dream. It's quite amazing to see that actually this is a concept, this year is now going live across the whole EU. Across all member states in the EU. So we think that should be applied in the UK as well.
And this is the sort of your Auntie Doris's Facebook page pops up with telling her that if she votes to leave the European Union, then she'll get all the Battenberg cake she can eat.
And
no one knew this existed. I remember watching footage. I paid quite close attention during the referendum, as you'd hope. I remember watching footage of Dominic Cummings boasting about the Facebook campaign that they launched in the really closing days and threw every penny they had left at it, and it was extraordinary. So it means everybody, including journalists, can scrutinise everything everyone is being shown, even if they're not being targeted themselves. We've talked about deep fakes and digital impersonation, and then really where it began was with content regulation for misleading election advertising, the fourth platform.
Exactly, and probably the most important one in many ways. So this is rules for factual claims in election ads. They're not opinions, manifesto promises. So as you were pointing out, if you're advertising a chocolate bar, you've got four sets of rules to ensure that it's accurate. If you're advertising an election ad to influence votes, there's absolutely nothing. This was one of the key recommendations from the Democracy and Digital Technology Committee in the House of Lords that Lord Putman chaired, who now chairs our campaign.
And it was a
unanimous recommendation from them. And actually, this is something that's proven to work as well. We've set up a sort of election ad review panel to demonstrate how it could work in the UK. But actually, there's precedents in other countries. So in New Zealand, it's been up and running for a couple of decades. Two states in Australia have got it in place with moves to bring it in federally too.
Well, we'll get this clipped up and get it out there into the ether. I mean, there's a large number of people listening and watching us now, but the clip will obviously reach parts that other media adventures can't reach. How would we prove now that we're not deep fake? We couldn't.
Well, so we also think it should be labelled when parties
it's not.
Do it.
This is why it's important. So yeah. I am James O'Brien, and you are Alex Tait. But there was no way we can prove that.
Well, this is the disinformation environment we're heading into. You go onto some of these platforms on X, half the content on it you can't really be sure is real or not.
Absolutely invented.
One thing I was wondering if we could ask as well is that, and we're a politically neutral, not-for-profit organisation run by unpaid volunteers, our next stage for this is to try to influence MPs to get them to include it in amendments, and then you need to get MPs to support the amendments. And we'd like to ask if your listeners feel as passionate about this as we do. We've got a functionality on our website, reformpoliticaladvertising.org. If they click on Take Action, email your MP. You can amend the email, but it takes less than a minute to do that, and it just really helps kind of increase the sort of pressure for MPs and show why everyone thinks this is important and why it's important to include in the bill.
I endorse this message. So it's reform political advertising. Yes, it is. This is the real me. I endorse it. I'm James O'Brien, and I endorse this message. Reformpoliticaladvertising.org.
That's right.
And you just, it's all very self-explanatory when you get there. And what you are calling for is clear and prominent party identification on all election material, a transparent, searchable database of all election adverts, AI deepfakes and digital impersonation being properly regulated, i.e. banned, and content regulation for misleading election advertising. So if you want a level playing field, if you want a fair and free electoral process, you should absolutely be on board with all of this and all of the work that Reform Political Advertising does. Alex Tate, thank you.
Thanks.
It's 12:02.
On your radio, on the LBC app, and
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation, this is LBC.
From Global's newsroom, the Prime Minister says protecting households from rising costs will be a priority as the conflict in Iran pushes up oil prices. Markets have dipped sharply after Brent crude climbed above $100 a barrel for the first time since 2022. Speaking at an event in London this morning, Keir Starmer said ministers are closely monitoring the potential knock-on effects.
People will sense, you will sense, I think, that the longer this goes on, the more likely the potential for an impact on our economy, impact into the lives and households of everybody and every business. And our job is to get ahead of that, to look round the corner, assess the risk, monitor the risks and work with others in relation to that.
President Trump earlier reacted to the spike, saying the short-term price increase is a very small price to pay for world peace. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, will join G7 finance ministers in a virtual call to discuss the situation this afternoon. In other news, the internet regulator insists fines for companies failing to keep children safe are acting as a deterrent. Since LBC's first online safety day, we found Ofcom's issued more than £3 million worth of penalties, but only £55,000 of that has been paid. Speaking to LBC, Ofcom's chief executive, Melanie Dawes, has defended the figure.
This is one of the most challenging jobs, I think, that you can imagine in regulation. And the Online Safety Act is more ambitious than any other global set of rules. So it's a really, really big task. I'm proud of what my teams have achieved in the first year, but we're absolutely clear that we need to keep on moving.
And there's more on this story on the LBC app. A Network Rail says Glasgow Central Station will remain closed today and likely remain shut tomorrow following a nearby fire. Services are not stopping there after the fire broke out yesterday in a vape shop. Fire crews remain at the scene. No injuries have been reported. In the city a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 143 at 10,141. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.15. LBC weather, cloudy but dry for most. Some patchy rain for the west, a high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom, for LBC, I'm Dominic Ellis.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low, slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg. Flared, straight or skinny?
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. They will affect how you manage your tenancies. Act now. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting-is-changing.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation with James O'Brien.
It's 5 minutes after 12 and you are listening to James O'Brien on LBC. More on Online Safety Day later this hour when Natasha Devon joins us to share the fruits of some of the work and research that she's been doing in this space, which is actually where she spends an awful lot of time when she's not behind the microphone at LBC. You can read an article by her. In fact, to be correct, Natasha Devon, MBE. Did you know that, Keith? MBE. You can read an article by her on the LBC website today about some of the stuff that we will be talking about later. I've made an executive decision. Can we have some sort of noise, Keith? Like a fanfare? Have we got a do-do-do-do-do or something like that? Got a lot of requests for me to play my tiny violin more often on the programme. I don't know if you were listening at the end of last week, but I did indeed do an impersonation of a tiny violin. And you were smitten. People have asked me to record albums. But anyway. Executive decision has been taken. We're not going to do Should the King Go to the United States on a state visit next month. Because we can do that any time, can't we, between now and the imminent visit, or now and the point when they announce that he is not going to go, or he is going to go, at which point it becomes dead as a potential conversation. But I'm interested by it. I just feel that we talked for 14 out of 15 hours last week about events unfolding in Iran, and so far we have added two more hours, effectively, to that list. So that makes 16 out of 17 hours, not counting guests and Henry Reilly's little visits. We've made a decision on that, by the way. We are calling it Reilly's Reform Roundup. Reilly's Reform Roundup. We're not calling it the Farage Files, because that could be something a little bit different as the political pictures develop. So we're doing something soft, we're doing something nice, and we're doing something that is not in any way allied to misery, murder or mayhem. We're talking about Timothée Chalamet, the star of Marty Supreme and sundry other films, and his unfortunate comments in a podcast being made with the actor Matthew McConaughey. I beg your pardon, in an interview with Matthew McConaughey for an interview in Variety magazine, where I'm sure slightly tongue-in-cheek, but that won't stop us having a bit of a chinwag about it. He said this.
And I don't want to be working in ballet or opera or, you know, things where it's like, hey, keep this thing alive, even though no one cares about this anymore. All respect to the ballet and opera people out there. I just lost 14 cents in viewership. But, damn, I just took shots for no reason.
That's not a shot. I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
What does that mean? I just lost 14 cents. Do we know what that means? Is it a figure of speech? Do you know what it means? I don't know what it means. Do you know what it means? I don't know what it means. Someone will know what it means. And of course, it wasn't tongue-in-cheek, but it was off-the-cuff. I mean, two slightly different things. And he's picked upon two art forms that are, I mean, easily derided, aren't they? They're easily attacked because they're quite niche. Opera and ballet. And predictably enough, because the media now dances on a sixpence, if you pardon the pun, the great and the good of opera and ballet have queued up to, largely in good nature, give Timothée Chalamet a bit of a ticking off after he claimed that no one cares about opera and ballet. But they've taken the comments relatively seriously. The heads of the Royal Ballet and the Royal Opera and the English National Ballet and Sadler's Wells and Scottish Opera have all seen the opportunity for a little bit of free PR, or at least getting their organisations into the papers, and invited the Marty Supreme star to come to a show. What's slightly surprising about the story is that his mum is a trained ballerina who studied at LaGuardia, and his grandmother was a Broadway dancer, while his own sister trained at the School of American Ballet. So, I mean, it's not just with the opera and ballet going public that he's going to be in relatively hot water. He's presumably upset his mum and his sister. So here's what I want to do, OK? Do you remember, we should probably dig out that call. Do you remember that lovely, lovely lady who'd never been to the opera? She'd never been to the opera, had she? And she really wanted to go. So we spoke to our friends at the English National Opera, and she went, and then she got back in touch and told us what had happened. I'm going to tell you something that I am entirely unembarrassed by. Okay. And there's something about what you might loosely describe as high art that demands an absence of embarrassment. I'm sure you've noticed this. People poo-poo things that they don't understand, and they poo-poo feelings that they don't feel. And I'm sure we've all been guilty of this. I know that I have in the past. I hope I'm no longer guilty of it, but you do something and you derive enormous pleasure from it. And because I don't get it, I don't feel that pleasure, I don't understand why you feel that pleasure, something about the way many humans, not all, but something about the way many humans are wired, invites mockery or derision. I told you about a month ago about my adventures in train spotting, didn't I? And it was probably the first and last time I'll go train spotting. And I only did it because it was just up the road from where I live, like literally a bus ride away. And because also London Centric, the Substack that Jim Waterson puts together, is just a brilliant, brilliant exercise in modern journalism. And he revealed that this new engine, the best battery powered, the most successful battery powered train ever, was going to be running on a branch line 2 miles away from me. So I went. Not because I'm fascinated by trains, but because I was at a bit of a loose end. And I like exploring the part of West London that I live in. This was in Ealing, just up the road from where I am in Brentford. And I really enjoyed it. And I also do quite like trains, but not to the point normally of making a visit. But I mention this solely because train spotting is such an easy thing to deride and to mock. And the reason for that is partly because we're always, I think, subconsciously hoping that somebody else is on the receiving end of any negativity that's in circulation. So you point over there at someone a bit geeky or someone a bit nerdy, and it means that the bullies, whoever they may be or wherever they are, aren't going to come for you. But I do honestly think that there's a sort of, I don't know what the word is to describe a negative reaction to something born of failure to appreciate. It's like, I don't get that and I don't do it, so I'm going to mock it. One of the maddest things that's happened in the years that I've been doing this job is that reading and good food have been typified by idiots as middle class concerns. Reading books and good food, nice recipes, even healthy food, quinoa, I've done that. How many times? Have you heard me do that? I've done that. Couscous. I bloody love couscous. Couscous is delicious. If you don't know couscous, get Jamie's recipe from his first book, the really simple one with the peppers, the roasted peppers and the stuff. I mean, come on. Why would I have been a person that used to pull a face and do a silly voice when I was talking about couscous? Or quinoa, much, much more nutritious than couscous, of course. But I did, because I fell into this trap. Someone's doing something and I don't get it, therefore I must mock it. But reading is heartbreaking. Some of the stats now about the amount of reading that people are doing, plummeting, especially young people, especially young boys, and it's just like shutting down parts of your brain. I told you once, and I really mean this, that when I first started going to therapy, when it started working, it was as if I'd lived in a house for my entire life, but there were rooms and maybe a garden that I didn't know existed. And that's what therapy does, is it allows your own consciousness and your own brain to grow and move past the things that have held you back or the obstacles that you've erected to protect yourself from pain or trauma. And reading is like that. Kids who don't read are just shutting their... Imagine a house of the mind, right? Imagine that your mind is a house with 50 rooms in it. If you don't read books, you're literally locking doors. It's not just books. You can play video games. I've just finished Ghost of Yote, which is one of the most powerful artistic experiences I've had in a very long time, visual and intellectual, verbal and physical. But you're just shutting doors. The less culture you're exposed to, the more doors in your mind you are closing and sometimes locking and then bricking over so that you don't even know that a door used to be there. So we do this thing where we don't get it. Down with reading, down with good food, down with opera, down with ballet. And that's what Timothée Chalamet has done. He has looked at things that he has been exposed to, one imagines, because of what his mother and his sister have done in the past, and he has not felt moved by it. And therefore, he has maligned it. It's not a hefty criticism of the lad. He's only young, and I used to be like that myself. The tofu-munching wokarate, Andy says. Do you remember that one? I do. Tofu's delicious. Tofu in a good laksa, it's just gorgeous. Couscous, but we did... I don't know what it is. What is the feeling that we are articulating when we pull a face and do a silly voice because somebody is enjoying something that we don't understand or we don't appreciate or we haven't heard of or we don't get? And I think that's what Timothée Chalamet is doing. I think that he doesn't get opera and he doesn't get ballet, so he is sneering at it. He's sneering, right? He is sneering at it. I don't want to be involved in something that is dying or whatever it was that he said. I began 10 minutes ago by telling you I was about to tell you something that I'm supremely unembarrassed by. And the reason I stress that is because I'm fully conscious of the fact that I would have been embarrassed once. In fact, I would have been so embarrassed once that I may never have told you that I went to a classical music concert in a local church. It was free. I told you this at the time, but you may not have been paying attention, or, God forbid, actually weren't listening to the programme. In which case, obviously, I'll need a letter off your mum by the end of morning break. And I went along to it. And I'll tell you what they were called, because I'm not going to do it from memory in case I forget and get it wrong. But I'm sitting in a church at a free concert done by people who perform every few months in this context solely to bring music to people who may not otherwise have encountered it. And I caught myself. I got a bit transported. Do you know that thing when your brain goes into a... No, I'm going to say a different dimension almost. You're just... You forget, and great art, whether it's, and by that I don't mean the canon, I don't mean Mozart or Beethoven, you're just so into something, particularly music, and it can be anything, that you're not in the day-to-day. You are freed from the quotidian, and you are flying. Douglas Adams used to talk about a moment in his work when he throws himself at the ground and misses. That magnificent sense of just being free, free as a bird, soaring through the atmosphere. And art does that to you. And I'm sitting in the pews, and I mentioned the seats, because they were quite very hard on the buttocks. And I didn't notice my bum had gone numb. I didn't notice that the church was a bit drafty. They were playing music, only a what are they called? A quartet. And I suddenly noticed that my cheeks were soaking wet. I had tears pouring down my face. And I don't remember that ever happening before. It's happened since. It was as if I opened a gate somewhere inside me, and now it's not closed again. It's open again. And I sat there with tears pouring down my face, which I couldn't articulate. I like words, you've probably noticed. Not bad with words. I couldn't explain to you what had happened to me. I wouldn't have been able to say. I just got a wordless emotional response. An emotional response that was not filtered by vocabulary. It was visceral. It was primal. It was pure. And I have never known anything like it before or since. Now, I haven't had that with ballet. But unlike Timothy Chalamet, that makes me want to find it. That makes me want to go and sit in an audience and be moved to tears or moved to emotional detachment by other people dancing. I've been to ballet and I have enjoyed it, but I've not had that a moment of extraordinary liberty. And I've had it with classical music, and I've actually had it since then at the opera. Not that I go to the opera a lot, although I really, really, really recommend the English National Opera, which has all sorts of schemes and offers available to make it accessible to as many people as possible. So that's what I want you to do. I want you to have a go at describing it. I want you to tell me why Timothy Chalamet is wrong and what opera and or ballet do to you. We might throw classical music into the mix as well, because opera is a broad enough church to accommodate that. That's what I want you to do. What is it? What's he missing? 0345 6060 973. And what I really want is someone who is a million miles away from the stereotype image of what an opera buff or a ballet buff would be like. Okay? Natasha Devon with us at 1:30, of course, to continue with LBC's sterling work on Online Safety Day. Before that, of course, it could be you. So it's opera, it's ballet. It's a person listening to this who just doesn't get it and might be tempted into negativity like Timothy Chalamet. Try and sell it to them in a way that will make them want to go. Okay? 0345 6060 973.
This is LBC.
Imagine a breakfast wrap. You know the one, because there really is only one. Sausage, egg, cheese, bacon, and a potato rosti all wrapped together. Yep, there it is. I think my work here is done. Served until 11 a.m.
The tax year end on April the 5th is approaching, so don't let your 2025-26 tax-free cash ISA allowance go to waste. Make the most of it with a 4.01% rate from Marcus by Goldman Sachs, the five-time Which-recommended savings provider that's backed by over 150 years of Goldman Sachs expertise. Open your Marcus cash ISA at marcus.co.uk. Time's ticking.
Interest rate is 4.01% AER, 3.94% tax-free variable, includes a bonus rate of 0.74% tax-free fixed for the first 12 months, rate correct as of 5th of March 26.
A lot of legal decisions in this country are made by magistrates, volunteers, like you and me, working as a team to make decisions on cases in criminal or family courts with support from legal advisors. You don't need specific qualifications or experience. I'm an electrician myself, but you could be anything. A teacher, a delivery driver, unemployed. With ongoing support, you'll learn new skills, enjoy new challenges, and help create positive change for your community. Volunteer at icanbeamagistrate.co.uk.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
So I couldn't do it with train spotting. I tried. And what I loved about my little trip to the station where this historic electric engine was being introduced was that the enthusiasm of the train spotters was infectious. But I don't think it was one I was ever going to feel. I was never going to be giddy with joy in that moment in the way that they were. So none of us are going to be capable of enthusiasm comparable to that of the biggest enthusiasts. There will be opera buffs who go to the opera and enjoy it in a way that I will never enjoy. But it's a spectrum, isn't it? And if you are, like Timothy Chalamet, persuaded that opera and ballet are for the birds, what would persuade you otherwise? How would you explain to somebody else what they are missing out on? That's the crucial question. Anthony is in Hastings. Anthony, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. First-time caller. I'm an opera singer and producer myself, so I know a little bit about the subject.
Welcome. How did you get into it?
So I had a, in inverted commas, normal job when I came into professional life. I was in finance and marketing, had a standard job, but did AmDram, and people said you know, I had a voice, and I took it from there. Don't come from a background of wealth, but I come from a background that loves music and loves expressing emotion. And I found that I fell in love with opera and became a singer and a producer. And
so did you not know before you joined in local groups that you had? Did you sing much as a kid? Did you sing much as a younger person?
I sang at school a bit.
But not on any level of, nothing outside of school, nothing extracurricular?
No. I got into the Royal Academy of Music without actually having a singing lesson. So I realised that I had something and took it from there. But I was in musical theatre for a while. But then I realised that I didn't think opera was for me. Yeah. So much like Mr. Chalamet, he thinks opera's not for him, ballet's not for him.
What happened? What changed?
I randomly got a role in a production of La Boheme back in 2009 in a pub in Kilburn, where we staged Act Two in the pub amongst all the drinkers, and that won the Olivier Award the next year. Funny enough, there's a film about it just come out recently.
What's the film called?
It's called, well, it's La Boheme. It was originally by a company called Opera Up Close, but it's now the director's film. Wow. And I realised opera was just about storytelling, and it would communicate emotions and stories that sometimes words fail to.
I don't know if you're aware of the phone-in I nearly had 15 years ago, and there's a story in the paper, Anthony, about the 8% of the population didn't have a phone, and I came this close to saying, "Give me a ring if you haven't got a phone." And I'm doing that a bit, aren't I, today? Come on the radio and put into words what can't be put into words.
Yeah, it's exactly that. But the thing is, we're all artists, and I was, and like many in the opera and the ballet world, was pretty incensed about what what Mr. Chalamet said, without the knowledge of him trying it. It's like saying, I don't like Brussels sprouts, but I've never tried them.
Yeah.
And so my I would simply say to people, go and see an opera, go and see a play, go and see a ballet, go and see any kind of art form, and I guarantee you will enjoy it. Opera is just another way of telling a story. The music and the staging, and the costumes, whether it's grand or whether
so you were cross with him then? Or I mean, incensed might just be a figure of speech, because quite a lot of the people that have been contacted by the newspapers are a little bit tongue-in-cheek, or they're availing themselves of the opportunity. But there's a snobbery inbuilt here that presumably you've been on the wrong end of in the past.
Totally. Yeah, and I don't come from a snobby background, and I think this moniker opera is elitist. That is for the birds, because you can experience opera in schools. I do a lot of school workshops. My next big community opera down in Hastings is going to involve schools and community ensembles, and it's going to be really about a place-based thing involving Hastings heritage. So it's not just for grand houses. It can be in schools, it can be in restaurants, or it can be in grand theatres like English National Opera you just mentioned. Mm. But there is an experience for everyone to take away.
It nourishes the soul, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And the less nourished your soul is, the smaller it gets.
Yeah, 100% agree.
I do believe that. How can people find out more about what you're doing down in Hastings, Anthony?
So my company's called Prologue Opera. We haven't got this next project up on the website yet,
because we're right.
waiting for a few things.
Of course.
But Prologue Opera is the company, and the show is going to be called Monster in the Maze by Jonathan Dove. It's a fantastic piece. Okay. But I would just encourage anyone to open themselves up to that experience. After all, what are we if we don't do that?
Yeah, what are we without that? I don't know why the word soul seems to be so intrinsic to all conversations like this. What are you nourishing? And you come from a place of sympathy and support for the people who haven't ever had their souls nourished in that way. Don't apologise, as I would have done once, for being reduced to tears is a funny phrase. Moved, that's the one I want, moved to tears. Oh, what a, you know, you could make a kind of slightly homophobic comment at that point back in the day, I think, when I was a younger man, I'd have been in that kind of environment, or you would make a class-based comment, or combine the two. But why? If your soul exists, if that thing inside you that responds to emotions, to love, to hate even, If it exists at all, why wouldn't you want to look after it in the same way that you would look after any other part of your makeup, physical or psychological? And for the record, I thought that Marty Supreme was very mid, actually. I know everyone else has gone mad for it. I like Timothy Chalamet. I think he's been brilliant in other things, but I do not for the life of me understand the fuss about Marty Supreme, the film that is his very good chance of an Oscar winner. Although, personally, I hope it goes to Michael B. Jordan. The Technology Secretary, Liz Kendall, will be taking your calls on this radio station from 1 o'clock. Sheila Fogarty will be in the chair, or Sheila Fogarty will be in this chair, but Liz Kendall will be in that chair. And that means that you can put your concerns about online safety direct to the woman who is, if not in complete charge of it, then certainly in the room where it happens, or if you've got anything that you're confused by or anything that you want to see more of, then Liz Kendall will be taking your calls with Sheila Fogarty from 1 o'clock today, all part of LBC's Online Safety Day, which continues, as you'd expect, for the rest of today. Natasha Devon will be with me, our colleague Natasha Devon will be with me after this to well, to tell you about some of the work that she's been doing in the field of children's exposure to AI. The time now is 12:30, and Amelia Cox has your headlines.
Sir Keir Starmer says protecting households from rising energy costs will be a priority as the conflict in the Middle East inflates oil prices. Brent crude climbed to above $100 a barrel for the first time since 2022, causing markets to fall sharply. Ofcom insists its fines for online companies failing to keep children safe are acting as a deterrent, despite a fraction of them being paid. LBC has learnt the regulator has collected just £55,000, £3 million worth of penalties have been issued. In Glasgow, Central Station will be closed today and likely tomorrow following a nearby fire. It broke out in a vape shop yesterday. LBC weather, cloud breaking in places this afternoon to make way for some sunny spells. These will mostly be in eastern areas. It'll be cloudier in the west with a few scattered showers in places, a high of 15 degrees.
LBC.
Okay, do emails. Ah, burnt toast. And now I've got to sort my repeat prescription.
Or just tap the NHS app.
The one I've already got?
Yep, you can check test results, view your GP health record and request repeat prescriptions anytime, anywhere.
All while the kettle's boiling?
Before it boils. And turning on notifications means you'll know the moment you get a new message.
Mm.
We're delivering an NHS fit for the future. Never miss a message. Request repeat prescriptions and more when you tap the NHS app.
We asked patients at Great Ormond Street Hospital what makes someone special.
They can make me laugh lots and lots and lots and lots.
They have to like arts and crafts.
Their favourite food is chocolate cake.
They might be a magician, so they can magically make me better.
They will be kind.
Does that sound like you? Be someone special and leave a gift in your will to Gosh Charity. Search Gosh Legacy for your gifts in wills guide.
Thank you.
Turn up your taste buds with Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces. From mild creamy garlic and black pepper, to bold smoky garlic and sun-dried tomato,
whoa,
and spicy smoked paprika and chili.
Woo-hoo!
Try Dolmio Intensify pasta sauces with serious flavor. Dolmio, yeah.
Whether you still own it or not, if you had a diesel car built between 2009 and 2020, you could be entitled to compensation. Checking takes minutes at jointheclaim.com, and if successful, compensation could be worth thousands. Diesel emissions claims are still open for Ford, Nissan, Renault, Mercedes, BMW and Jaguar Land Rover. Don't miss out. Join millions of drivers across the UK. Check your vehicle now at jointheclaim.com.
Join the claim!
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall. Energising a better Britain.
33 minutes after 12 is the time. Some lovely messages coming in, including quite a lot of agreement with me regarding Marty Supreme. Let's see if it wins the Oscar, then maybe we can have a conversation about it then. But we will return to the magic, the beauty of opera and ballet, the thing what happens when you are in the presence of art that moves you. And it doesn't have to be high art, but we're talking about high art, and we will continue that conversation shortly. But first, Natasha Devon, who you will know, of course, from her sterling work on LBC, is with me. When did you get the MBE?
2016.
Really?
Yes.
You were very young to get an MBE.
It was a long time ago. And I've since joined a campaign group to change it to British Excellence, because I don't like having Empire after my name.
Fair enough. I mean, to be fair, I'd quite like to be in a position to worry about
that. It's a first world problem.
But I'm not. It is 12:34. What have you been up to?
So last week I went to Global Academy and I did a focus group with five young people aged between 16 and 18 there. And the conversation we had, completely reflective of the conversations that I'm having. I'm in about two or three schools and colleges a week all over the UK. And we spoke about online safety. And I began by asking them about whether they would support a ban for under 16s. Unsurprisingly, they weren't fans of that idea.
Right.
It's interesting, when you ask young people about their hypothetical future children and if they would allow them to have social media at the age they started accessing social media, then the answers get interesting. And they start to tell you about things that they thought they were too young to have seen, perhaps. But we did have a conversation about VPNs. Have a listen.
Increase recently, like in this past year, because of the act.
So is the primary reason to get around restrictions?
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah.
I think especially on 16-year-olds, if they've grown up with social media their whole life and been allowed TikTok and Snapchat, if that's completely taken away from them, like, immediately, they'll just find a way around it.
They're very eager because they feel like they're missing out. It's like FOMO. For example, I remember growing up, like, my friends were allowed Snapchat before I was, and I was like, oh my gosh, this is so unfair. Like, looking back, I'm like, yeah, thank God I didn't have it.
And that's really interesting because one of the primary arguments that's made against a ban for under 16s is that they will all just get VPNs. They told me that...
I think a quick translation of VPNs for Keith.
Okay. It stands for Virtual Private Network, and what it allows you to do is get around restrictions that have been put in place
for
your geographical area. Lots of people have them. You do generally pay for them. And the reason that people have them is that it can keep your data more secure as well. But they told me that they got VPNs, pretty much everyone they know, when the Online Safety Act came in.
So that they could access pornography?
Just so that they could access things that they felt might be taken away from
wow.
them. Not necessarily pornography, but they did talk to me about accessing, for example, things which are sometimes blocked. So information about what's happening in Gaza, for example, is sometimes blocked on social media for younger users.
Gosh. And so a plurality of them, not just like two or three in the corner of the class, but most of them had paid a few quid a month to have a kind of internet access that is entirely unfiltered and undiluted.
It's very widespread, very okay. widespread. And of course,
I didn't know that.
My fear about, I'm kind of, my heart is in favour of a ban for under 16s. My head is not quite there yet. One of my concerns is that there'll be a kind of Kemi Badenoch attitude where we go, well, we're going to stop regulating it because children aren't seeing. And it's like, well, no, there are things that adults shouldn't be exposed yes. to either. So that was one of the conversations we had. We also had a conversation about the right time for a child to get a phone. They all thought that the start of secondary school, all children should have a phone for safety reasons. We had this really interesting conversation where I said, look, when I was 10, there was no internet. There was no email. There was no Google.
When I was 25, there was no internet.
Yeah.
So I
should say
some VPNs apparently are free. I should have known that. My bad.
Okay.
So they won't necessarily be spending a few quid on it.
So I said, you know, when I was 10, the phones didn't exist. Do you think that I was more or less safe when I was going to or from school? They said that they thought that I was more safe than their generation. But one of the reasons that they gave is because everybody has a phone. So they said a 10-year-old could be filmed, could have a camera stuck in their face at any moment. And they felt that around 10 was the right time. Have a listen to what they said.
In about 11.
Okay. Late year 6. I don't know how old I was. Wait, maybe 10 years
late
old?
Year 6 is when you should get a phone. Because you're for safety. You're walking home by yourself. You're not a primary student anymore. You're like on the doorstep of becoming a high school student where you need a phone. You need your parents. You need to be able to contact them whenever because you'll be traveling by yourself. A child should not have a phone at 9.
So it depends what you're using it for, though, because when I was like, I think about 10 years old, I was walking home from school or walking to a friend's house, like, on my own. So, like, there should be some sort of alternative. But at the same time, at 10 years old, you don't want to be having TikTok, scrolling all day, having Snapchat, just wasting your time.
I did mention to them after we had that discussion that there is a campaign called Smartphone Free Childhood. And one of the things they're suggesting is that 10-year-olds could be given a phone where you have Google Maps, you have your music, and I think Childline is on there, but you're not able to download apps like TikTok and Snapchat. And they thought that that was a really good idea. They were behind that.
You can see why I love that juxtaposition or that dichotomy between what they would want for themselves and what they would want for their own children. I think we were all guilty of that, actually, in terms of technology, and that you can recognise the negative aspects of it, but when it's you, you're focusing almost exclusively on the positive aspects, or you're persuading yourself that the positive aspects outweigh the negative aspects. The final bit of the work that you've been doing, and for people who don't know, Natasha spends her working life, when she's not here on Saturdays on LBC, working in the education sector, particularly in the sphere of young people and their mental health. As with many other areas of the interplay between newish and emerging technology and humanity, it's AI that is really in your sights.
It is, and this is something that has been expressed to me by teachers for a long time now. There is a fear that young people are using AI chatbots like ChatGPT as therapists. And I've actually written a piece for LBC Views about that today. My reason why that is happening, I assumed, was because it's so difficult for a lot of children and young people to access mental health support. The young people that I spoke to at Global Academy had a different reason. Have a listen.
Well, trust. Because, I feel like that the AI bot doesn't actually judge you. When you're looking at someone, you're telling someone how you feel.
It's like eye contact. Yeah.
Sometimes it's overwhelming.
Yeah, they know what you're feeling. And maybe not just a therapist, but maybe, for example, your friend, they might just tell someone else.
That's a big thing. People as well,
they're obviously thinking something, like whether it's, it might be positive, it might be negative, they do have an opinion on what you're saying. Whereas a chatbot is probably just going to tell you what you want to hear.
It can tell you to do something that is not ideal.
Sometimes when people turn to artificial intelligence, it won't always go the way that they wanted. And if they turn to their friends, it could also be a thing of they have past trauma from talking to other people and they've like spread their business and they just may feel like, I just need to keep this to myself and just talking let it boil up.
Sometimes it's also a bit overwhelming because you're putting your stress on another person.
Well, again, as with the VPNs, it sounds like they're all doing it.
It was something that they said without me prompting, even though it was already on my radar, and they did tell me it was quite widespread. I mean, there's a couple of things there. First of all, this idea that it's completely anonymous when you talk to a chatbot. I don't think they fully understood that a therapist has to maintain confidentiality, and the companies that run AI chatbots make no such promises.
That's such an important point. And also that good therapists, and you're not guaranteed a good therapist, doesn't judge. That's the whole point. It's I suppose subconsciously you can't help thinking they must have an opinion, but they are trained not to. Otherwise, they wouldn't be able to do the job that they do because they'd take your trauma home and they'd be obsessing about the difficulties that their clients are facing. That's terrifying in some ways. I mean, how worried should we be? ChatGPT might be doing a great job.
Well, there are several ongoing lawsuits about AI chatbots and the data.
I spoke to a mother who lost her son, actually.
A man in Florida is currently suing because he believes that the advice that was given to his son by a chatbot led directly to him taking his own life. As they've identified, they've said, you know, they might not give good advice. I think we should be really, really concerned about this. Social media obviously is still an issue and it's something that teachers are grappling with. But with AI, I think there's an opportunity to get ahead of it a little bit more. We just let social media happen to us. And then a decade down the line, we assessed in retrospect the damage that it had done. With AI, I think we need to be much, much more proactive.
We got no excuse, whereas we had an excuse back in the day because it was happening in front of us, and you know the visions of people like Tim Berners-Lee could have come to pass, but didn't. Whereas with AI, the warnings are coming in almost as quickly as the technology. So, what exactly are they doing, Natasha? Are they going down, saying to ChatGPT, they're just listing their worries, sharing their worries and their concerns and their fears and their issues with technology.
Where they would have once talked to a friend, they're now talking to something that in their view won't judge them and won't spread gossip about them. Those were the main advantages that they identified. But just to say that Mind, the charity, are launching a year-long investigation into this because it doesn't just affect young people. People of all ages are using chatbots in place of therapists.
And of course, the story that always frightens me is the one about the girl who put up a picture of herself and took it down quite quickly, which informed the algorithm that she was probably self-conscious and she was probably insecure about her appearance. So the next thing you know, she's been bombarded with advertisements for makeup and worse. And these platforms are going to be part of the same information harvesting networks, aren't they? So that's the naivest thing they said, and I use that word kindly, is that nobody else will be finding out. In fact, that people will be trying to sell them stuff on the basis of what they have shared with LLNs immediately.
And that example that you just gave in Careless People by Sarah Wynne Williams, who's a whistleblower who used to work for Facebook, she said that was a deal that Meta offered to advertisers of beauty and fitness products. They said, we can guarantee it will appear in the feed of a 13 to 16 year old user just after they have deleted a selfie. Precisely because that's a moment of peak vulnerability.
Yeah. Wow. The importance of having access to proper mental health support as well can't be overlooked. And I know this is the point you're making towards the end of your piece on LBC Views, because that's still a nightmare. CAMHS, you can't even get an appointment to see CAMHS unless you're already in absolutely terrible circumstances. But these young people turning to the technology because there is no alternative. There's nothing else there. Great stuff. You're back on this. Back in the studio on Saturday?
I am indeed, 6 till 9 p.m.
Nice to see your mum the other day.
Thank you very much.
Is she a Morrison's Best woman, or does she make do with a normal range?
I think she's actually prefers Aldi these
days. Does
she
really?
Yeah.
Lord, oh, Morrison's Best all the way. 12:45, Natasha Devon, thank you.
Coming up at 1 on LBC, Sheila Fogarty.
Tech Secretary Liz Kendall takes your calls on online safety. And Keir Starmer reassures but says there is risk for the UK economy from the war in the Middle East.
Sheila Fogarty at 1. Listen on our free Global Player app or the LBC app.
At TfO, we're opening up more of London for everyone with step-free access. We're continuing to improve accessibility at many of our stations, and now over 200 stations and counting have step-free access, including the entire Elizabeth Line, DLR and all tram stops. That is how we're making the greener way to travel more accessible to all. Search TfL Improvement Plan. To the Mayor of London and TfL, every journey matters. Greener than total estimated petrol and diesel car emissions.
Tesco Insurance are driving down the cost of motoring with 10% off car insurance. Take out a car insurance policy before the 15th of May 2026 and you'll get 10% off with club card prices. We offer a range of cover options so you can choose the one that's right for you. Save 10% when you buy or renew a car policy with Tesco Insurance. Search Tesco Car Insurance and get a quote direct today. Club card required. Excludes add-ons. T's and C's apply.
Octopus Energy. Great value and outstanding customer service. Recommended by Which? A record 9 years running.
BetMGM was born in Vegas. So just like the Cheltenham Festival, we know a thing or two about entertainment. Every ride, every race, every roar. This is Cheltenham Vegas style. Sign up to BetMGM now. Bet £10 and get £40 in free bets. That's right. Bet £10 and get £40 in free bets. Are you ready for the greatest show on turf? BetMGM. It's showtime.
Minimum stake £10 and customers only. Wagering requirements and conditions apply. 18 plus. Please gamble responsibly.
When you're smiling.
Banning Dental Group Clinics. With over 5,000 top-rated Google reviews. Keep on smiling.
Hi, I'm looking for a pair of jeans.
Right. Low slung, slouchy, wide leg, bower leg, curved leg, flared, straight or skinny.
Blue?
Fashion. It's hard to keep on top of. Other things, like the upcoming changes to renting, are a bit easier. As a landlord, you will need to get on top of these important changes. They will affect how you manage your tenancies. Act now. Read the guidance at gov.uk/renting is changing.
This is LBC.
With Vauxhall, proud partner of Team GB.
It's 12:48. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. Things that I have forgotten to do today and now don't have time. I've got an excellent unhinged headline and also an update on when you should mow your lawn. Yes, you have accidentally tuned in to North Norfolk Digital. Aha! With me, James O'Brien. I may remember to share that with you tomorrow, but we return to the question of Timothy Chalamet and his disparaging, I like that word, comments about opera and ballet. Partly the question of why he's wrong and partly the question of what he's missing that he could be helped to discover. Keith's in Balham. Keith, what would you like to say?
Hi, James. Thanks for raising this very important subject. I'm actually the composer of operas, and in fact, to illustrate my point, which is that opera has a capacity to cross boundaries, one of my operas was actually directed by Stuart Lee, the comedian.
Manifest Destiny! Manifest, the phone line is awful. You as a composer of operas will appreciate the importance of sound quality better than anybody. And we will get you back up imminently. I knew Stuart had directed an opera, and we'll find out more about it shortly. Well, hopefully we will. He also wrote one, didn't he? I think Keith worked with him on Jerry Springer, the opera as well. Anyway, we'll come back to Keith as soon as we get the phone line up and running. Before that, Ian is in Glasgow on this vexed question or twin question of, A, what he's missing, and B, how he could help discover it. Ian, what made you pick up the phone?
Hi, James. I was at Sadler's Wells on Saturday evening seeing Scottish Ballet, and Christopher Hampson, the creative director, made an announcement about this very subject just before the ballet started. So it's clearly on everybody's minds, but I'm from a really working-class background. There was no music in my family, and I was drawn to learn to play music, and in particular classical music. Now, I think at this point, it's really important to say it's different when you're a musician versus the audience, because how do you get people that don't play and aren't classically trained to come and see musical performances like that? And I think that these days, all the marketing and all the force is towards going to see people like Taylor Swift or Glastonbury. And this is not an either or, and me want to say we don't like loud pop music, but it's a different experience. And if what really made me pick up the phone was you saying that tears came to your eyes when you went to a small, intimate, classical performance. When people, when you can see, you can hear the scrapes of their violins, you can see their eyes, you can see their nerves, because it's very, very difficult playing in front of those.
And it just reaches parts that other things can't reach. What does it do to you, inside, not outside?
It brings tears to my eyes. My son actually is musical, and he sings with the National Youth Choir of Scotland and with the Royal Scottish National Orchestra's junior chorus. He's actually just gone beyond that now. He's a little bit older, but going and seeing all these children in a smaller environment or in a bigger concert hall where they're singing their hearts out really moves people.
It does, indubitably, and why you would want to deny yourself that experience is a question for the ages. Ian, take care. We'll be back to Keith imminently, but I just want to read this because it's tickled me pink. It's from Neil. In fact, I'll give you his surname because it's a clue. It's from Neil Cooper. Hello, James. I am writing from New York, where I am currently working at the Metropolitan Opera. My uncle was Sir Henry Cooper, and as a working-class Southeast Londoner, opera was something that I only heard via my dad's record collection. I sang at school and enjoyed the thrill of collective endeavour that music and theatre produce. Class plays a part. The feeling that opera, for example, is not for the likes of us. I often or always experience being deeply moved when I see or hear the collective work of orchestras, dance troupes, theatre and opera casts and choirs. I am understudying the role of Tristan here, and this piece has some of the most profoundly moving music ever written. It moves me every time. Opera is a vast canon, and people will find their tribe, as it were, if they explore. It takes work. Read the synopsis, the libretto, the translations, etc. Identify the moments that touch you, listen, and then listen again. And opera is not all good by default, but there are extraordinary voices and musicians that you will recognise when you hear them. I love that. Transcend. And also, you know, if you've never been to the opera, I bet you've heard of Henry Cooper. Keith is, well, back to Keith in Balham, a composer of operas, including Manifest Destiny, which, of course, Stuart Lee directed. What made you pick up the phone today, Keith?
It was actually an earlier opera of mine that Stuart directed. But the point being that Stuart, being a comedian, has access to a certain strata of society. Opera is perhaps perceived to be a sort of high art form, but it's very important that opera is an incredibly powerful art form that combines so many other art forms, music, literature, theatre, actually relates with society. So, for instance, in Manifest Destiny, is an opera about potential suicide bombers who renounce violence, and also a relationship between a Jewish composer and a Palestinian poet. And together they reach a point where their message actually leads to a new sort of peace movement across the world. I think it's incredibly important. I think Chalamet had a point.
Go on.
Chalamet, who I respect greatly because of Call Me By Your Name, that brilliant film by Luca Guadagnino, he had a point, which is that it's perceived to be possibly a moribund art form for the elite and for the upper classes.
Yes, it is.
And I think it's actually the duty of people who are in opera and ballet, rather than sort of saying to everyone, well, you ought to go. It's actually the duty to create new work that connects with society, that processes the contemporary experiences that we're going through. And think what we're going through at the moment with Iran, what we went through with Iraq.
Yeah.
These experiences are hugely stressful and demanding and difficult for all of us to comprehend, understand, live through. And opera actually is an art form which has a unique capacity to connect to the human heart.
Why does it? What is it that opera? Because I mean, I'm thinking about the number of dimensions almost in quite simplistic terms. Opera almost has more dimensions than other art forms. But why do you think it has a unique ability? And the word that's in my mind, Keith, is process. It helps people process things as well as moving them and nourishing their souls. If you're going to be talking about contemporary issues, it helps people process things in a way that other media can't help them process in quite the same way. Why is that? What's opera got that all the other art forms haven't got?
It has a unique
transcendent power of music to access our emotional life in an incredibly direct and deep way. And it combines with that the, if you like, the intellectual power of theatre and words. So once you've put words and music together, and then you've put the ritual spectacle of theatre together, I mean, what I would recommend everyone to do is to go and see an opera by Richard Wagner from The Ring Cycle, which are four related operas, which comprise about 20 hours of music, completely immersive experience. It's a unique achievement in human civilization. And it's just getting across that barrier that people think this is not for me.
Yeah.
But in fact, it's the most powerful experience you can probably ever have in your life.
Tell me about the first time you had it.
That was, in fact, at the age of 17, going up to London every day to see each one of the Ring Cycle operas, all four of them, with a friend. I remember our parents made the sandwiches. Yes. this is in the late 1970s.
Wow.
And that experience changed me because I realized what Wagner was doing. He was processing these incredibly complex societal issues, and he was doing it in a way that you cannot resist because the music is so overwhelmingly powerful, beautiful, sensual, seductive, and you simply enter another universe. And the idea that people would forego that experience, I'll give you one example. I worked in a charity for the homeless. I took someone to Rheingold, the first of the Wagner operas. When we came out, he said, "I'm still shaking." That's the power of it.
Wow, just picked him up and bounced him around the room.
Yeah.
I love it.
Someone like him who had no cultural reference points for the experience at all, it cuts straight through every barrier.
Completely raw. What a beautiful, beautiful story. What are you working on at the moment, Keith?
At the moment, I'm still developing Manifest Destiny, and you can look that up online, and there's a concert of my chamber music on May the 21st.
There we go. Get yourself down there. Keith Burstein, thank you so much. And apologies for getting my my compositions mixed up. It was Jerry Springer, the opera that you worked with Stuart on, was it? Or no, what was it you worked with Stuart on?
So there's an opera, it's actually a sort of science fiction opera called The Furthering.
Okay.
That was in 2002, actually. And he was writing Jerry Springer.
That's it.
At the same time, I went to the first little experimental backroom.
Great example of how it's a genre and art form that transcends a lot of the preconceptions and stereotypes. Thank you for that. It's a wonderful line that Will in Chesterfield has, I'd like to say, reminded me of, but I think I'd be being a bit pretentious if I said reminded me of, because I can't remember it from the times that I've seen Much Ado About Nothing. But Benedict is wandering through the woods, and he stumbles across a priest who's playing a lute and singing beautifully. And Benedict says, "Is it not strange that sheep's guts should hail souls out of men's bodies?" Essentially describing the mechanics of music, but it's the music itself that takes your soul out of your body. And that, of course, is what Keith Burstein has just been describing to us, the opera composer himself, that ability. That's what happened when he took one of the homeless people who he worked with in a charity to the opera. Their soul was taken out of their body and bounced around the room. So, Chalamet, we're not impressed. And also, Marty Supreme was about a 6 out of 10. It's coming up to 5.5. It's coming up to 1 o'clock. You're listening to James O'Brien on LBC. And if you missed any of today's show, you can listen back on Global Player app or the LBC app. They're all free. Podcasts as well, of course. James O'Brien Daily. Full disclosure with Naz Shah this week. I mean, truly, truly extraordinary woman with an extraordinary story. Have a listen. You won't forget it. Download the official LBC app for free from your app store now. Coming up at 4 on LBC, it's Tom Swarbrick. But now it's time for Sheila Fogarty.
Thank you very much, James. People will know already, if you're listening to LBC, we're focusing on online safety again today for the third time. We're going to give it a great deal of our focus. Technology Secretary Liz Kendall is here to take your calls in just a few minutes. The broadcast regulator Ofcom has recovered just £55,000 of fines of over £3 million that were imposed on companies. So just how much is the new bill working, the new legislation working? The war in the Middle East, of course, is still dominating the news as well. Keir Starmer attempted to reassure us over a new cost of living crisis because of that war as oil prices rocket. We'll reflect on that as well. Here's an example of what some countries are doing. Croatia has imposed a maximum price for retail oil.
On your radio,
on the LBC app. And
play LBC.
Leading Britain's conversation. This is LBC.
From Global's newsroom at 1 o'clock, the Prime Minister says the government is doing everything it can to protect households from rising costs caused by the war in the Middle East. For the first time since 2022, the cost of Brent crude oil has climbed above $100 a barrel. There are fears it could have a knock-on effect to the price of food and transport. But speaking at an event this morning, Keir Starmer said they're keeping a close eye on it.
The longer this goes on, the more likely the potential for an impact on our economy, impact into the lives and households of everybody and every business. And our job is to get ahead of that, to look round the corner, assess the risk, monitor the risks and work with others in relation to that.
Donald Trump dismissed a spike in oil prices earlier, claiming that the increase would be short term and it's a very small price to pay for peace. Ofcom insists fines for tech firms failing to keep children safe online are a deterrent, despite a fraction of them being paid. LBC has learnt in the year since our first online safety day, the regulator has collected just £55,000, but it had issued six firms with penalties totalling more than £3 million under new legislation. Tory peer Baroness Morgan has told LBC she wants to see Ofcom being given even tougher powers.
When the next version of the Online Safety Act comes around, the measures that Ofcom can use, how quickly they can react, are all things that are going to have to be looked at again.
And the Tech Secretary, Liz Kendall, will be joining Sheila to take your calls on LBC next. Glasgow Central Station will remain closed for the next 2 days following a fire at a nearby vape shop. No services will be running today and likely tomorrow. No one was injured and the fire is now under control, but emergency services are still at the scene. In the city, a short time ago, the FTSE 100 was trading down 134 points at 10,150. The pound buys $1.33 and €1.15. LBC weather, cloud breaking in places this afternoon to make way for some sunny spells. These will mostly be in eastern areas. It will be cloudier in the west with a few scattered showers in places, a high of 15 degrees. From Global's newsroom for LBC, I'm Amelia Cox.
Okay, that's six of the ragu and the linguine. Make a move, everyone, please.
The customers are rolling in at Stefano's new restaurant, so he needs another chef. Someone with a cool head and an appetite for success.
More flour in the bechamel, let's go.
Indeed can help him find great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. Sponsor a job on Indeed to unlock more tools that save you time and help you hire quality candidates. To start hiring, visit indeed.com/try today.
This is LBC from Global, leading Britain's conversation. Call the Cabinet. Put your questions to Technology Secretary Liz Kendall now.
Hello there. Good afternoon to you. I am not the Technology Secretary. Liz Kendall is, and she's here in the studio with me. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
You'll know probably that this is the third time at LBC we have done what we call Online Safety Day. Of course, every day needs to be Online Safety Day, and in many households very much is, isn't it, when you think of the efforts that parents in particular are going to make it. So can I start with fines and Ofcom before we get to the calls? And I'll get to the calls very quickly. LBC found today that just 55,000 of the almost £3 million of fines have been collected. Mm-hmm. Will they be collected in full?
I expect them to be. I expect Ofcom to enforce this. And if the fines aren't paid up, we'll see what further action we need to take, because companies who want to act here have to obey the rule of the law here, and I expect the money.
If you don't get the money, is it time to look again at using Ofcom for this? Is it not time for the teeth and the levers of government to get more involved?
Well, there's two things. One is that Ofcom not only has the power in law to fine companies up to 10% of their qualifying worldwide revenue if they repeatedly fail to abide by the law, but they also have what's called business disruption measures. Essentially, Ofcom can apply to the court to make sure those services aren't available in the UK if those companies repeatedly refuse to abide by the law. But, you know, if they don't pay up those fines, I'm obviously prepared to look at what more government could do to make sure we get that money back, because the law of the land needs to be enforced in our land. You know, one of the things I've always thought, Sheila, is technology is moving unbelievably fast. And it took us as MPs, I think, something like 8 years all the way through to get the Online Safety Act in place.
Too slow.
Now, it's too slow. We every year have a finance bill, don't we, on a budget. If we need to be legislating every year on technology, that's what we need to do to keep pace.
Is there an appetite? I've heard you mention that before. Is there an appetite in Cabinet for that?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Oh, definitely in Parliament, but also in the Cabinet, because we're seeing things move more quickly, and politics sometimes seems terribly frenzied, but I think sometimes it can be very slow, and patience isn't my greatest virtue.
Do you want to pop your headphones on, yep, and we'll get to George? George has called from Cheshunt, and he has a question on algorithms. Oh, George, we all have questions on algorithms. Fire away.
We sure do. Hi, Liz.
Hi, George.
Thanks for... right, so my son Christopher was murdered by predators he met through social media. So since then, we've set up a charity, Christopher's Charity Foundation, CCF World, and it's to help prevent this happening to other families. Now, algorithms on social media are helping predators find children. Will the government introduce stronger protections, something like the Christopher's Law, to make these platforms responsible to protect young people?
George, do you mind me asking how old was your son when this happened?
Christopher was 15 years old, yeah, and he passed away March the 1st, 2022. And it's very, very weird that many other parents lost their children in the same month and the same year. Mm. Which there's a lot of unanswered questions.
Yeah,
but I think algorithms play a massive role in all of this.
Well, I will make sure I follow up on the specific issues that you are campaigning for. What I would say is two things. Firstly, that we are consulting at the moment on whether we should ban social media for those who are under 16. Also looking at issues, I don't know how he was contacted, around issues around games, you know, stranger mm-hmm. pairing. We need to look broadly here, and we will be finishing that consultation in 3 months' time. We'll put forward our proposals by the summer. But we're also making sure a lot of parents who've been in this terrible situation that you have, and I'm so sorry about that, that they feel that they can't get hold of what their kids were looking at online. So we are legislating on these data preservation notices, which is essentially that coroners can put a kind of block on the social media companies getting rid of that information, so that they can, so parents and coroners can access it to look at what their kids were looking at, to get answers to their questions, because the not knowing, I think, is one of the hardest things.
Do you have full answers, George, over Christopher's death, or do you still need and want to see more of what he was doing online?
Well, I don't know whether I should use the word fortunate, but I have found a lot of information that Christopher went through after we lost him. We received a message on Discord saying to him just minutes later, "Are you dead?" And we've also seen that he was having chats with four individuals, but then it was identified that those four individuals were actually one IP address. So that's really, really scary.